Welcome, everybody, to the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Today is December 12th, 2016. Welcome. I want to start off by saying that there has been a party arranged at 4 o'clock for our retiring members, Democratic House members. So that means we know that Representative Gallegos is for sure going to be going, because we will be celebrating him. And it means that many of us are going to want to be a part of that celebration, too. So I'm going to try to – we have a very packed agenda. We're going to try to keep it moving along. Some people who have not been here before, we're really eager to hear from you. People who have been here before and we will see often again – I'm looking at some of our agency people. We will try to not ask you too many questions and keep it moving along because we know we're going to have more opportunities to see you. So this is just going to be a very brief overview of some of the big issues that we will be facing in the session. And we don't know who will be back on this committee next time. So the other reason for doing very brief overview is that we will probably be repeating a lot of this information in January when we have new members of the committee. So I just want to make apologies up front for doing a brief overview, not getting too in-depth here, but really want to appreciate everyone for coming. Want to appreciate my committee members for being back here after tough election seasons, and remaining committed to these issues. So thank you. So with that, I want to open an informational hearing on Oregon Housing and Community Services with the director, Margaret Salazar. You've got a lot to catch us up on.
I do. Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Margaret Salazar, and I'm Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. I do have a lot to update you on today, but I'd also like to take a few moments just to introduce myself to you, tell you a little bit about my background and why I'm so enthusiastic about the work of our agency. I am a native Oregonian. I grew up on a cherry orchard in Hood River, and as a young person, I split my time between Hood River and Portland. I started my career in the San Francisco Bay Area, where I worked for a foundation funding community organizations working for social, economic, and environmental justice across the western states. I got very passionate about the issue of affordable housing during the dot-com boom of the late 1990s. During that time, we saw a swarm of folks moving to the Bay Area brought in by the tech boom. And unfortunately, as housing prices skyrocketed, we saw low-income people, and in particular people of color, facing displacement and lack of stability in their housing. Folks were either priced out or left behind, and we saw folks lose their foothold in a stable and secure place to call home. I got involved in local affordable housing campaigns, and I've been passionate and engaged in the work of affordable housing ever since. After working at the state and local level in California, I then joined the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. I worked for HUD for 10 years, first in our San Francisco office, then in the Washington, D.C. headquarters, and then finally back home here in Oregon. While at HUD, I had the opportunity to finance affordable housing development and preservation across the United States, working with communities large and small, and engaging with public housing authorities, local government officials, private investors, tenant organizations, and many more to come up with creative housing solutions for communities all over the country. Under my leadership, HUD was able to work with local partners to preserve more than 10,000 affordable rental homes across the country. 2.5 years ago, I had the pleasure of being able to move home here to Oregon and serve as Oregon Field Office Director. And in that role, I had the great privilege of working closely with Oregon partners all across the state on issues as varied as veteran homelessness, manufactured housing parks, fair housing and equity, and affordable housing preservation. So I bring all of those experiences to the table today in my new role as Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. As you know, Oregon Housing Community Services does tremendous work. We provide financial and program support to create and preserve housing opportunities for vulnerable and low-income Oregonians. We have a dedicated staff of 134 talented individuals who work with our partners across the state, including community action agencies, developers, housing authorities, and our partners at DHS and OHA, and many others, to reduce and prevent homelessness, to lift families out of poverty, and to create and preserve housing opportunities. In the past year, our agency has really done some tremendous things. In 2015, we funded more than 1,500 units of affordable housing. We created more than 300 loans for first-time home buyers. We helped 2,200 homeowners avoid foreclosure. Our individual development account program today is helping more than 3,000 Oregonians save for future investments like education and homeownership. And we've also provided homeless funds to more than 15,000 families in need, and we've helped over 81,000 families in need of energy bill payment assistance. However, despite all of these great accomplishments, our agency faces a number of challenges. As you are aware, last week, the Secretary of State Audit Division released a performance audit of our agency, and it provided some pretty tough feedback for us to face. As you can imagine, some of the information in the audit was difficult for us to hear. However, as the new incoming director of the agency, I actually found the audit to be a very helpful document to help me identify the challenges that we face and some of the recommendations for how to meet those challenges. The audit focused on affordable housing preservation, but it also took a much broader look at our agency's operations, and I have three major take-home points to share with you today. The first is in the area of data and technology. The audit highlights our need to modernize our data system so that we can have a clear and accurate picture of our affordable housing portfolio. It also explores how our data systems translate into a negative user experience for our customers and for our staff and creates inefficiencies in our programs. The good news is that OHCS had already identified the need to procure a new modern data system, and we are already engaged in a procurement process to secure a new system that will include an electronic underwriting platform, will integrate data from the development through the asset management and oversight ends of our portfolio, and importantly, will allow us to report out accurately on the health and the trends of affordable housing in Oregon. We are working with DAS on that procurement. We are nearly halfway through the stage gate process overseen by the CIO, and our goal, of course, is to obtain a system that has been used and tested by other housing agencies so that we're not reinventing the wheel. The second major take-home point from the audit is in the arena of strategic planning and the statewide housing plan. The audit calls on our agency to complete a statewide housing plan as mandated by statute, to document the housing needs of various populations across the state of Oregon and different demographic groups as well, and to allow us to identify the solutions to those needs. Again, here the good news is that OHCS had already prioritized the creation of a statewide housing plan. That work is already underway. Our staff is now completing our initial data analysis, and we are about to issue a request for quotation to engage a planning firm to help us engage in the robust stakeholder involvement that will be required for the plan, to engage our housing council in that work, and to create a user-friendly plan that will be accessible online. Related to the statewide housing plan, the auditors also found that our agency needs to do a better job of strategic planning. We need to do a better job of identifying and communicating our outcome-based goals for the agency. The statewide housing plan work will do the data and research piece that we need to inform those strategic investments and help us to create multi-year goals. However, as I've shared with the OHCS staff, given that we're in a housing crisis, I don't think we can wait until the statewide housing plan is completed to get clearer about our goals and our outcomes. We need to get clearer now on how our work today impacts Oregon communities. We need to start setting metrics on measurable outcomes, and we need to track our success and our challenges in meeting those outcomes. That's why I've asked staff at all levels of the agency to provide input and build one-year goals for calendar year 2017 for our agency. Those goals will serve us in this one-year interim period while we're completing the statewide housing plan and moving toward a multi-year look at our programs. The goals will touch on rental housing, homeownership, homelessness, and helping families move out of poverty. The final major theme of the audit has to do with communication and transparency. The auditors found that we're not doing as good a job as we need to do of engaging our employees and the statewide Housing Stability Council in the decision-making and prioritization work of our agency. With regard to employees, I'm working hard to solicit input from employees at all levels of the agency. I truly believe that program innovation starts with the employees who know the programs the best. So we are developing a platform of employee engagement, leadership development, and communication reforms that will be part of our work in that 2017 plan. The audit also speaks of our need to better realize the vision of the Housing Stability Council as a policy and program decision-making body. So starting in January, we will be engaging the council in those discussions. We will be holding a day-long retreat for the council in January, where we'll be talking through the role of the council, how to engage the council members earlier on in the decision-making process, and to present our proposed strategic goals for 2017 for their input. Finally, I'm working to shore up our relationships with our key stakeholder groups. Our partners deliver housing and programs all across the state. Their input is absolutely invaluable to our success, and we're exploring ways to better strengthen our relationships, perhaps through informational exchanges and training programs between our staff and staff of the key stakeholder organizations as well. Of course, in addition to all of those themes, the audit also talks about affordable housing preservation, which is an issue that's near and dear to my heart. Preservation must be part of our agency's strategies to address Oregon's housing crisis. Our existing affordable housing stock is a critical component of that work. We have work to do to better understand the preservation need, which the audit clearly finds. And we need to also wrestle with how to prioritize our scarce resources between new development of housing units and preserving the affordable housing that we already have. The audit provides some good ideas from other states that we will be looking into as a first order of business. The governor's recommended budget allocates $10 million for lottery-backed bonds for preservation. This would allow us to preserve an estimated 200 units of affordable housing. This resource is sometimes referred to as gap financing, and it is critical leverage for preservation deals. I will be meeting with key preservation stakeholders in the weeks ahead to better understand the preservation need and our options for the coming biennium and over the long term. As we work to address all the issues identified in the audit, we are, of course, also hard at work to implement some exciting new programs. So I have a couple of updates for you there as well. So first on the LIFT program. As you know, our agency made $40 million available in 11Q bonds for the LIFT program through ANOFA earlier this year. For that $40 million, we received $61 million worth of requests from 17 projects. We are still reviewing the applications, but we are pleased to see that the program is oversubscribed and that folks think it is a promising model. I can tell you that the proposed projects come from both urban and rural communities alike. And many of the proposals are contemplate combining the LIFT with the 4% low-income housing tax credit program, which to date has been an underutilized federal resource that we think is a great way to leverage the state investment. We think that's a promising structure, and we're looking forward to hopefully announcing those awards in early January. As you know, the governor's recommended budget includes $60 million in additional funding for the LIFT program. It also requests staffing for our agency to fully stand up and administer this new program. And I can tell you from my experience in launching new programs that this additional staffing will be absolutely critical to be able to deliver on the promise of LIFT and make the program successful. I also wanted to provide a quick overview on funding for EHA and SHAP. I know you'll be hearing more about those programs later in today's agenda. So EHA, or the Emergency Housing Assistance Program, assists low or very low-income persons who are homeless or at risk of becoming homeless. EHA funds pay for services including transitional housing, homelessness prevention, rapid rehousing, emergency shelter, and veterans services. Program funds come from legislatively approved general funds as well as the document recording fee. From July 1, 2015 until present, EHA funds provided services for more than 39,000 individuals, more than 14,000 households, and more than 65,000 bed nights of shelter. SHAP, or the State Homeless Assistance Program, offers state funds to help meet the emergency needs of homeless Oregonians by providing operational support for emergency shelters and supportive services to shelter residents, including facility maintenance and operations, resident support services, and data collection and reporting. From July 1, 2015 until present, SHAP funds provided services for more than 53,000 individuals, more than 18,000 households, and more than 234,000 bed nights of shelter. We make EHA and SHAP funds available to 18 community action agencies that represent all Oregon counties. These lead agencies are responsible to coordinate the use of funds to serve their communities. So that's an overview for you today. And in closing, I just want to reiterate how honored I am to be serving in the role of Director of Oregon Housing and how honored I am to speak to you today. Thank you so much.
That was great. Thank you, Director. Any questions? Representative Evans.
I have a question and a request. First of all, congratulations and handling the report the way you did. Knowing where you're going to start is a good thing. As you're building the strategic plan, one of the things that I know among folks in our district, we would like to have a little more information about how and what approaches you're looking at for veterans housing, not just in terms of a per vet voucher, which has often been the deal, but as far as the flexibility for the document recording fee pool for perhaps group or program efforts, getting vets from homelessness into more long-term sustainable environments. So as that progresses down, I'm going to be very interested in seeing how we can make sure and stretch those opportunities a little farther than maybe we have in the past.
Great.
Just want to put
Thank
that
you for there. The comment. Okay. Representative Buehler?
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. Thanks for your presentation, and I realize you're new to the job, but if you come back in 6 months, could you give us three key objectives that we should judge your first 6 months' performance? What do you want to achieve in those first 6 months?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Buehler, thank you so much for the question. So a couple of things. So certainly on the data and technology front, I think we will be far along the process of procuring that new data system. We absolutely need to be able to show movement there. Of course, we're using the new stage gate system, so some of the timing of that is out of our control. But we need to be moving forward to have that data system. I think the audit makes that very clear. I also would say that within the next few months, we need to have, as I mentioned, very clearly identified measurable goals for our work, whether it's the number of housing units, whether it's the percentage of folks that we are moving out of homelessness, and be able to come back with clear reports on how we're measuring our success and how we're tracking that. And then finally, I think that the other component would be on the LIFT program, to be able to announce those awards and be able to explain how we're moving forward on actually implementing that and moving the housing to actually get built. So those are three key areas we'll be focusing.
Can I just do a quick follow-up? When do you think you'd have those key performance metrics established and you could share with us?
Representative, we should have those by February.
Wait, we can invite them back in February. Yeah, Representative Gallegos.
Thank you. And welcome to your new job, and congratulations. I just want to share with you that I spent 20 years on Catholic Charities Board and 10 years as a corporate officer in Caritas, their development, housing development program. I'm just very sensitive to the whole issue of the complexity of putting these partnerships together and really trying to achieve these very broad and ambitious goals and objectives. But I have to say that I'm extremely frustrated, with the planning proposal that you laid out. I mean, it's like 4 years I've sat up here and listened to planning and, goals and objectives being set and et cetera, and here it's like we're having to start all over again, and I hope that's not the case. I share the concern about really developing some measurable goals and objectives. I think one of the things I think that was missing for 4 years listening to the reports from the agency was a clear goal, a clear mission. What is the end result that we're really shooting for? And hopefully a strategic process will help us to sort of articulate that kind of a measurable and attainable goal. I think with that, the other thing I would say is that I do hope that we'll continue. I can also back up and appreciate the, I don't know if you ever saw that agency flow chart, the spaghetti map. And so I'm glad we were able to get rid of that. But I hope we can continue to streamline sort of your decision-making process. I'd also hopefully that we'll see a more streamlined process in the transfer of resources to our community services programs. So, thank you.
Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Kenny. So I'm certain you're probably already aware of this, but given that you're new in the role and just to make sure the dots get connected, we passed a bill in 2016 related to UGB and affordable housing and a couple pilot programs, and numerous stakeholders came together during that just from all over the place. And one of the groups that came in were a group of U of O researchers that talked about, extensive data on affordable affordable housing throughout the state and the needs that are here. And that was one of the things cited in the report, was that the agency was lacking in some of those things. So that might be a good starting point if you haven't been made aware of that connection. OHCS did have a staff member sitting through that grueling process as well. But that's a great starting point for research, so you don't have to reinvent the wheel on everything.
Great. Thank you for your comments.
Thank you. Anyone over here on this side? Okay. I had one specific question, and then I was going to make an overall comment. You talked about the 4% federal housing tax credit that has been underutilized. Could you say a little bit more about that?
Certainly.
Why that may be?
So, Chair Kenny-Geyer, the 4% low-income housing tax credit program, and forgive me, this might get very technical or wonky, but it is a federal tax credit that relies on private investment. So private investors work with nonprofit housing developers, and there's a syndication of tax credits that go that create equity for these projects. The 4% program is a non-competitive program, meaning the limitation is the state volume cap. And there are a number of reasons why the program has been underutilized. First, it doesn't generate enough equity to make a lot of deals work, particularly in rural areas, hard-to-develop areas of the state. And so often you need to create gap financing resources. And the gap is larger in those projects than in a 9% low-income housing tax credit project. Mm-hmm. So one of the reasons why those deals aren't workable is that they just haven't been able to pencil out. Mm-hmm. But another reason is that I think we have not really made it a priority to promote the program, to sit down with our partners, figure out what we need to do to make it more workable, more efficient, maybe streamline some of the steps. And I'm pleased that OHCS has actually taken a number of steps to create, you know, work groups with our stakeholders to talk about how to more fully utilize that program. And I think also, you know, the audit provides us some great examples from other states that we'll be looking at for how they've been able to, for example, reach more rural areas of their states. So we'll be looking at some of those issues as well.
That's great. Thank you. So my overall comment is that I think you're bringing a wealth of experience to this. I'd love that you were in Washington, D.C., and you had the opportunity to see how many other states were doing so many of these specific programs. I think that's going to bring a lot to what we have here in Oregon. I did note, and I noticed that the report is not yet in OLIS, so if you can make sure that the housing audit does get into OLIS, at least from what I can see. It's not in the materials section yet, but I want to call attention, obviously, to the beginning, which is a summary. Page 5, I thought, had a really good summary of the needs. One of the things that really stood out is 12.5% in home values between July of 2015 and 2016, average across the state. And rental housing is currently increasing nearly 7% a month. It's outstanding. At the same time, it says increasing costs combined with relatively stagnant incomes since the 2008 recession results in housing costs taking a bigger chunk of Oregonians' paychecks. There's a lot more information on that page about the need. Also, the incredibly low vacancy rates across the county, including 0.5% in Deschutes, which is Representative Buehler's, Crook, and Jefferson counties. So we know that this is a really challenging problem across the entire state, and there's a lot more statistics that go into the percent, the very high percent, majority of people who are seniors and people with disabilities. Again, in rural areas, that seems to even be more of a problem. So I know that we need to keep taking a very statewide look at this. We're going to be hearing about Portland, and in particular, Representative Evans, some of the success they've had in partnering with the federal agencies and being able to effectively erase, for the time being,
short-term
veteran homelessness. But I think when we really focus on an area, have specific goals and go after it, we can achieve those kinds of those gains. What I would say about the reorganization is, you know, there's a sweet spot somewhere. We tried very hard to streamline and reduce the number of positions, and yet one of the things that is pointed out in the report is by losing the 5 regional managers, we lost a lot of communication with some of our stakeholders, even though we tried to build that back with 2 different positions. So good luck in trying to figure out the governance pieces. Lastly, I would just say that we really need more resources. We can talk about how data affects how we are not as able to meet the preservation needs as we think, but the other big issue is lack of resources. So we gave $5 million to preservation when there was a $20 million request in the last biennium. So we didn't get close to meeting the need. I am delighted to see that it's now a $10 million request. I know that advocates had wanted $100 million in there, so we're only just scratching the surface. And I hope that in this next session, with some direction from you, with some very targeted goals about what we need to do for different regions of the state and for different segments of the population and for different pieces of the continuum, from homelessness to rentals to home ownership, that you can really set out what it would be, even though you know that resources are hard. I still would like to know what is the goal, and then how can we work all together to try to reach that goal. Because the numbers that we have right now, with $60 million from LIFT, $10 million from preservation, $9 million, I believe, in EHA and SHAP, where we gave $19 million in the last biennium, we're not going to be solving our housing crisis, no matter how good a job you do with governance, if we don't have some resources to match that. So it's a big challenge. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Representative Buehler?
Yeah, I would just comment, since it was a long question, that even though more resources certainly needs to go that direction, there's no amount of resources that the state of Oregon can provide to fill the housing gap. We need more supply, and that is the ultimate solution to this problem.
Exactly. And I do mean, when I talk about more resources, I mean resources for not only meeting tenants' needs and supporting home ownership, but also for increasing the stock. So absolutely. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you.
Oh, okay. Do I need to close this? Yeah.
It's all information.
Okay. So I just want to let you know there is overflow seating available in Hearing Room F. Okay. And so next we have a report on Emergency Housing Assistance, State Homeless Assistance Program, EHA and SHAP, with Rose Beck.
Good afternoon, Chair, committee members. My name is Rose Bach. I'm the co-director of Youth and Family Services at Multnomah County and also the Community Action Director for Multnomah County. I'm here to talk to you about EHA and SHAP, and I know that Director Salazar gave you a little bit of an overview, so I'm going to try to just focus on what these programs have looked like on the ground from the community action perspective. I'm one of 18 community action directors throughout the state of Oregon, and I can tell you whenever any of us get together, invariably we start talking about the housing crisis the last couple years, about homelessness, the housing is lack of housing assistance and the lack of affordable housing. And both EHA and SHAP have been invaluable tools in the fight against the incredible increase of folks who are impacted by these this situation with housing. First, I'd like to talk about the State Housing Assistance Program, or SHAP. Oh, I'm sorry, the State Homeless Assistance Program, or SHAP, which, as you heard, provides operational support for shelters. So what does that mean? In Multnomah County, it's meant over the past few years that we've been able to braid SHAP funds with local funds and in-kind contributions from our faith-based partners to create a year-round no-turn-away shelter for people with children. So in Multnomah County, no child has to sleep outside at any point of the year. That's how critical that's been. Additionally, we've seen, at least in Multnomah County, a big increase in women, unaccompanied women, many of whom are victims of domestic violence or sexual assault on the streets. And with the additional allocation of SHAP that we received this year, we were able to open a new women's shelter in Multnomah County that's housing an additional 90 women, as well as an additional 45 units of what we call scattered site shelter for survivors of domestic violence who need to be in a confidential location. So it's been critical for that. But shelter's not the answer. I've been working in housing and shelter for over 20 years, and I can tell you the people in the shelter look very different than they did even 5 years ago. Increasingly, we're seeing seniors with walkers and oxygen tanks in the shelter, which we would never have seen before. We're seeing a huge increase in LGBTQ, particularly youth who identify as LGBTQ. We've seen an increase in women and survivors of domestic violence, and also just an enormous increase in the amount of children. And I think we can all recognize that being in shelter is not ideal. The longer people are in shelter, the more likely it is that they'll experience negative impacts around executive functioning and trauma and other bad educational outcomes. So EHA is where we really try to look at how we can keep people out of the shelter. Right now with this situation, we can't completely eliminate shelters, but if to the extent that we can keep people from becoming homeless in the first place, that's where EHA is our key tool. So there's a variety of uses that Director Salazar mentioned for EHA. In Multnomah County, we've really focused it on rapid rehousing, homelessness prevention, and assistance for veterans. Those folks are all 80% of median income or below. And we've really tried to focus on a rapid rehousing approach. So as people come into the shelters, we try to get them out as soon as possible and get them housed. Many people in the shelters, which is another thing that's relatively new over the last five or 10 years, is many people in the shelters are working. But if you move into a new place, you need, you know, a security deposit and first and last month's rent, and that can be thousands of dollars for folks. So we try to get people housed as quickly as possible, even, you know, driving people to units to help them look, or vouching for landlords, giving them temporary assistance as they need to. We've also focused our EHA money through our major eviction prevention program, which is called STRAW, the Short-Term Rent Assistance Program, which is a collaboration between Multnomah County, cities of Portland and Gresham, and Home Forward, our local housing authority. And what we try to do in that particular program is help people not become homeless in the first place. So if somebody's got an emergency where they need a couple months help for rent, maybe a medical bill or car repair or some other kind of an emergency, we can help stabilize them. Or if they're the victim of a no-cause eviction or a huge rent increase, which I know you've all heard about quite a bit, we can help them, you know, maybe pay the rent for a couple months while we transition them into a place that's more affordable to them. So it's really been a key program for us. So the folks that are helped by both EHA and SHAP increasingly are veterans, victims of domestic violence, children, seniors, and people with disability who've been priced out of the market. So SHAP really keeps people off the street and out of living in their cars, or in some cases keeps people from having to stay with an abuser because they don't know where to go, where EHA really helps folks not get homeless in the first place. It's a key program for us in terms of stabilizing the economy. In Multnomah County, we are a little different than most of the community action agencies because we're a county, and we contract out our EHA and CHAP fund to our nonprofit providers, which provides a lot of jobs in our nonprofits, often for people who are coming out of the same systems that they're now working in. So it's a great kind of economic booster for our nonprofits as well. One of the key things I want to stress about both EHA and CHAP is the importance of how flexible the funding sources are. For example, I have a series of funding sources in Multnomah County that are funded by HUD, which I'm extremely grateful for, but the amount of work and documentation and paperwork it takes to help somebody rent an apartment with HUD funding versus SHAP, or sorry, versus EHA is huge. You know, and when people are in crisis and we have to ask them to jump through a lot of hoops and get a lot of paperwork and do a lot of documentation, it just adds to their trauma. The other key thing is the flexibility. So how we are using the funding in Multnomah County, I know, looks very different than how they're using it in Klamath or, you know, in Pendleton. But because we've got that level of flexibility, we can very quickly and very creatively provide some solutions for people who are at risk of homelessness or are homeless based on what we need in our individual communities. And that's very important to us. The service, we can make the services as quick, as long, as mobile as we need to in order to help people quickly and as effectively as we need to, and also just a way to build on the local services that are available. So if we've got services in Multnomah County that we can use to help folks, so we can use our funds a little differently than maybe another community where they don't have the range of services that we do. The additional allocations this year of EHA and SHAP have been a lifesaver, I believe, for all of the communities. We are averaging in our EHA and our STRAW program 15 requests for assistance for every household that we can help. So we literally could take 15 times more money than we have right now to fill the need. And I know you'd hear this from every single community action director in the state. So, you know, although it doesn't fill all the needs, it fills a lot of the needs. And the things that we can do to keep households stable and to keep them out of dangerous situations is just critical. And I know you're on a time constraint, so I'll stop talking and see if you have any questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Okay. So next we have Lisa Bates on rent stabilization.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Lisa Bates. I am an associate professor of urban studies and planning at the Toulon School in Portland State University, and I was asked to come and speak to the panel today about our knowledge in the housing policy and housing economics community about rent stabilization policies, perhaps give a little bit of an overview of that research, literature, and the sort of analytical frameworks that you might use as you consider as the statewide preemption on rent regulation policies. Just as a preface, I'll say that any change to policy regarding housing has costs and benefits that are differentially distributed. In other words, they increase costs for some, they decrease costs for some. Some people are benefited and some people's benefits are reduced. That's what happens when we change policy, right? And economics is a useful analytical framework for understanding some of these effects and their distributions and their outcomes in terms of equity. It's not a perfect framework or method, and I'll say a little bit about why that is the case. There are some kinds of outcomes and impacts that are not well measured in the economics literature, and I would suggest that it does not quite provide the full framework for judging as a community, as a jurisdiction, as the state of Oregon, whether those outcomes are good or are better than the status quo. So right now, considering a change to state law to allow local jurisdictions to make their own determinations about policies concerning the regulation of rents, I'll say a little bit today about what rent stabilization or regulation is, what are the benefits and costs that we can assess in the research literature, sort of try to answer the bigger question of whether it works, and you know, sort of conclude by suggesting some ways to think about this going forward. So when we talk about rent stabilization or rent regulation, we often, I think, have in our mind a very stringent form of rent control. That's an absolute cap on rents. That is a policy that really does not exist anywhere today. A very short-lived policy from the World War II era. From the 1970s on, when we talk about rent regulation, we're really talking about stabilization and sort of graduated increases in rents. There is a constitutionally recognized obligation for owners of rental housing to have due process and a fair return on their investments. And those are sort of fundamental concepts to the case law that upholds the constitutionality of rent regulation. Rent stabilization and regulation is a broad and can be very flexible policy that really needs to be attuned to a local jurisdiction's market conditions. Right now, it exists in about 4 states in the District of Columbia, but in many jurisdictions within those states. These policies differ in their regulated increases of rents that can happen on an annual basis. There are some jurisdictions that set the increase by formula. Others set it with a rent board that considers rents. Those formulas may be tied to things like the consumer price index, to the market rate for unregulated housing. They sometimes differ depending on the kind of housing or kind of tenancy that exists. So it's really quite flexible. And there are ways that the landlord can mark to market or increase their rents more than the graduated amount, for example, when they make substantial improvements to the building. Some jurisdictions also decontrol or deregulate at vacancy. So when a new tenant comes, the rents can be increased outside of the regulated amount. They may be re-regulated at that point, or they may be decontrolled altogether. There are also different, you know, a variety of ways to handle things like property conversion and, again, major reconstruction or redevelopment of a property. In most jurisdictions, new construction is also not included. And that means that there are some large jurisdictions in which no units built since the mid to late 1970s are included in rent stabilization at all. So, for example, in New York City, Washington, D.C., we're talking about units built sort of prior to the mid-70s. This is a policy that addresses what we in the housing policy community refer to as NOAA, naturally occurring affordable housing, and the recognition that the vast majority of low-income renters live in market-provided low-cost housing. They don't live in subsidized and regulated housing that has government dollars flowing through. They live in the market. And so I think that's an important component of the housing spectrum that needs to be thought about. So oftentimes when people talk about the question of rent stabilization, they'll sort of have a quip that this is Econ 101, right? Rent control creates problems for supply. So I like to suggest that there are some classes that happen after Econ 101, and that actually the Econ 101 concept of markets does not work when you analyze housing. Housing economics analysis is very complicated by the fact that it's a highly differentiated product that comes in multiple tenure forms that is very sensitive to finance in the market. And is spatially fixed. There's some other things that happen in housing markets that cause housing to violate most of the classical assumptions of economics, but I'll just leave it in saying that to analyze a housing market in a local area is fairly complicated. And again, one of the first steps would be to name the policy correctly. So yes, if you were to think about a policy that sets rents at some level and then they never change, you would have very serious impacts in the market. But that really isn't what people talk about today when we talk about rent stabilization. We're talking about something that's much more, typically is tries to attune much more to the market. And local conditions matter quite a lot. I don't think that anyone would advocate a single statewide policy for rent stabilization or rent regulation, because one would want to carefully consider local context in the market to think about the various factors and components of a policy. There is actually not a tremendous amount of scholarly research on the effects of rent stabilization. It's fairly thin. But when we look at that literature, we see a sort of pretty common set of benefits and set of costs that are listed. So in terms of benefits, addressing the displacement of low-income tenants is a pretty key one. So we think generally that stability is really important for families. It's important for children to maintain schooling. It's important to maintain jobs. And we also think it's really important for communities. And in fact, the length of tenure, the amount of time people spend living in one unit, is one of the reasons why communities often prefer homeowners in their neighborhoods, because homeowners live in places longer than renters do. And except in that, in instances with rent stabilization, renters have much longer tenures than the average sort of more frequent moving, particularly for low-income people. Hypermobility, so moving way too much, is a pretty significant problem in terms of disruption. And it's disrupting to communities and neighborhoods. These all have costs to us, the public at large. Rent stabilization also, as sort of an indirect benefit, makes other kinds of tenant protections more meaningful. It serves as an underpinning for policies such as just cause evictions or health and quality inspections for rental housing. It's part of a larger set of supports for quality rental housing in this naturally occurring affordable housing market, because without those kinds of policies, sort of economic-based evictions can continue apace, even if you have a just cause policy. So what are the kinds of costs that we have? The concerns are, one, deterring new construction. Again, many cities, nearly all cities, exempt new construction from rent stabilization for the reason of maintaining new supply in the market. However, that means that as new construction happens, if you don't move your base year forward, you may, you know, soon have a large component of your housing market decontrolled. In Cambridge, Massachusetts, with one of the more detailed studies of a total decontrol of what had been a very stringent rent control situation, property values went up quite a lot for units that were decontrolled. That's a benefit to those people who own those properties, may not be a benefit for others. clearly some owners of rental property will be impacted in different ways, right? We know that there's a large difference in the effects of rent stabilization from a large-scale property owner in a professional management situation versus a sort of individual person who we call sometimes like a DIY or accidental landlord, an individual person who may themselves be income constrained, who inherits a home, for example, and decides to rent it out. That person would be more affected by rent stabilization. There is some evidence during the recession that there was a slight uptick in foreclosure for owners of rental property in rent-controlled jurisdictions in New Jersey compared to non-rent-controlled properties. However, it's difficult to attribute that primarily to rent control when that foreclosure crisis was so largely caused by subprime refinance and home equity lines of credit. So there's other mechanisms that one could use to stabilize or offset some of those costs for small owners. They may also receive some benefit as tenants stay in their homes longer. They reduce their cost of turnover, of lease up, and may have better maintenance by tenants that live in a unit for a long term than tenants that move in and out quickly. The most recent article looking at 40 years of what they term moderate rent control in New Jersey, which just came out last year. It's one of the few very recent studies and large studies found no significant impacts on rents, on housing supply, and housing quality when comparing jurisdictions with rent stabilization versus non-rent stabilization, holding constant other market values. So on balance, so we ask the question, does it work? It's difficult to... Well, I would suggest that the question of does it work needs to be first grounded with a question of what we're trying to achieve. So it does become difficult to make an overall assessment of whether rent control works if we look at San Francisco or New York, very high-priced cities. But they have large portions of their rental market that are not controlled. And it's important to note that rent stabilization, rent regulation, and low rents are not the same thing. So if we have a mark-to-market type of policy that then increases gradually, that doesn't make rents low in a high-cost area. It maintains the growth of rents in a way that benefits current residents. So it depends on how rents are set. It depends on how easy it is to remove units from stabilization policies. And indeed, the authors of this most recent study suggested that due to the heavy influence of real estate industry on policy setting, that the first goal of thinking about a rent stabilization policy is to ascertain whether that policy is merely symbolic or if it is actually making a significant impact on rent levels at all. There is perhaps a more compelling argument that is that if rent stabilization only affects certain properties, that those people who are lucky enough to live in those units will experience the benefit and others will not. Of course, we know that when we look globally, only about 1 in 4 households that are eligible by their income level for housing subsidies receive such subsidies. We have a huge unmet need in terms of affordable housing, and so we live in a system in which getting government assistance for housing is already kind of a lottery. So we don't cover all eligible households as it is. There are some questions about the targeting of rent stabilization. So for example, in New York, about 2/3 of folks living in a rent-stabilized apartment are actually low income. It means that 1/3 of those units are occupied by people with high incomes. But again, literally all housing policies and programs at this point are somewhat of a lottery. And I think the question is whether we can braid together policies, resource streams, et cetera, to create the platform to keep Oregonians in safe, stable, affordable, and healthy homes. And I think as you move forward to consider the evidence and the balance of evidence, I would suggest that we can talk about in an economic way the kinds of costs and benefits and how they're differentially distributed across groups. But then the question of whether that distribution is preferable to the current distribution is a different kind of question. It's a question that, of course, you're well suited to talk about as those who are representing citizens of our state and to weigh those kinds of value decisions.
Okay, great. Thank you. Any questions, comments? Representative Buehler.
Just a question for you, Chair. Are we going to have someone who has a different perspective on rent control?
We are going to have a lot of people in the during the session. We're having a brief overview of some of the things that we're going to be discussing in 2017. And I think you cited several studies, I think, and any that you want to put on here would be great, Lisa, if you want to put it on the material so everyone can see it. But I think this will be a big part of the discussion of how do we help stabilize people. Certainly increasing the stock is at the heart of everything, but given that that's going to take us a while, if we can even find the resources, what do we do with the people who are so rent burdened now? So I think it'll be a big discussion. We will have a lot of both informational presentations, but then also we will be open to the debate.
So the short answer, we will have equal time to discuss a different perspective on the advantages and disadvantages of rent control?
Yes, absolutely. I absolutely welcome more informational hearings, and I think we'll probably have several in the beginning of February. And then, of course, it will also be open. Anytime we have a bill for discussion, we will have public testimony, and so we may get 75% of it with one perspective that maybe doesn't like rent control versus, you know, it'll be open for whoever comes down.
Follow-up question?
Follow-up?
Professor, it's been a long time since I studied economics, and I did go beyond a 101 level in economics. But I am skeptical that there's anyone who's so smart that they can determine the right return on equity, who can determine the right mix of housing, who can determine who actually should benefit from that rent stabilization, a variety of questions. I'm very skeptical.
Is there not a question?
Give me an example where that's worked well.
Well, so I would suggest that my conclusion to this survey of the literature is precisely what you're saying, that these are choices that we make as policies that are based on our best weighing of evidence about the potential costs, benefits, burdens, and how they're distributed across our communities and across different groups. And at some point, this the end of what economics can tell you about what will happen. I mean, it's not a crystal ball, but it's also not a value set per se. Right? There are costs to rent stabilization and there are benefits to rent stabilization. We can know what those are, sort of, or we can at least say who those accrue to differently. And then we can ask the question of, do we like that? Do we prefer that to the situation that we have now? Yeah. Do we think those costs are bearable? Do we think those benefits are preferable?
Yeah. I just have great concerns. Those costs are borne by the poorest among us by decreasing the quality of housing supply and decreasing the conditions of that supply. That's pretty clear in the economic literature on rent control, or if you want to dress it up in another term, stabilization. But, you know, the experience in Cambridge, and I think it's broad consensus, you know, American Economic Association surveyed economists, over 90% think that rent control is not a good policy to follow.
It's not actually clear in the current literature that quality is decreased by rent regulation. And I would say, again, it's not just because I don't use that term merely rhetorically, but because the actual policies in place are not the same as rent control. The surveys of economists, which are now about 10 years old, which ask about the policy of rent control, are asking about a very specific version of a policy that does not exist in jurisdictions today.
And it doesn't exist because why?
Because it didn't work.
Exactly.
It created serious problems.
Exactly.
And that's why we make a more nuanced
so Representative
set
Buehler,
of policies that have different kinds
exactly
of
Exactly why we've changed
Buehler,
the policy.
I want to rein this in right now. We're going to have 5 months to debate it. I think it's important to put the issues on the table. I think you presented very fairly that there are winners and losers and costs and benefits, and those are the kinds of things that we need to consider very carefully as we're looking at any policy. But I want to give a chance to Representative Parrish. You haven't asked a question yet. Please keep it brief because I know we have a lot more
material. I'm just curious if the literature you cite, because I've not read it, takes into account that these are people's private assets, and we're asking to make a public policy decision about something that somebody owns as an individual and basically reallocate that asset via the rent control process to somebody else. That's one piece of the question. And the other piece of the question is, does your literature address what other states are doing, where they're actually looking at giving renters a break on their taxes for the value of the rent, similar that you would a mortgage? I personally prefer incentives and things that give people back their money rather than taking other people's money and assets. But on all of the literature I've seen where people are, you know, excited about a rent control or stabilization or whatever you want to call it, none of it reflects the fact that we're making a public policy decision about somebody else's private property.
Right. So in general, an economics or public policy analysis that's based on economics, costs, and benefits is going to just take as given the policy that exists. Mm-hmm. As our legal system and our sort of constitution, and I think 2011, 2012, the Supreme Court declined to rehear the question of rent control, upheld rent controls or rent regulations that provide a fair return. So there's a legal basis for what is a fair return, and there is sort of a legal basis around what due process is. And so any policy would have to fit into that legal framework. And so the analysis would sort of take that legal framework as given. But that question is, again, that's that policy-making question as opposed to an economics analysis question. Do you prefer that version of an allocation or not?
But I guess follow-up. When you say words like allocation, you're talking about allocating somebody else's private asset through the public policy process. I mean, I guess it's been a while since I've been in college, but I didn't know that's economics anymore. Is that just that's I'm confused by your testimony, I guess, that somehow we're missing the piece about this is somebody's private property, and we're saying that we're talking about words like allocation and, you know, making policy around people's assets, personal assets that don't belong to the government. And I'm just kind of curious how the property owner fits into this, and if there's other ways to solve what you're trying to solve, which is what some other states have done, is say we're going to give you a tax break to the renter to help offset the cost of their rent rather than taking it from one person. If we're going to have a value as a society of saying we want fair housing, shouldn't all of us be kind of pitching into that and not just asking this private property owner to be shouldering that burden by themselves?
So how about a very quick response, and just know that we're going to have many months to debate this.
There's lots of interesting questions here, though.
Yeah. But we do have
two other well outside of the conversation I was asked to bring here today. So there is a set of legal standards around what is considered acceptable regulation of private property ownership. One of those standards allows for the regulation of rental income. That's not me saying that. That's not economic research saying that. That's a standard that's been adjudicated through our court system and considered as part of our Constitution. So all I can say is that exists, a variety of ways that we regulate land use and property owning. This rent regulation and rent stabilization, as it exists in a number of jurisdictions, is not considered an unlawful taking by our under our constitutional standards right now.
Can I ask just one simple question?
Save it for her for afterwards. I really want to get through the rest of the agenda. You were not here in the beginning when I talked about trying to get through the agenda really quickly because there's actually a party for retiring members at 4, so I'm really trying to get through as fast as I can. We're not going to solve this question. These are values debates as much as anything else. Thank you for introducing the subject to us, and if you would like to put any of them on the materials for OLIS, that would be really helpful so people could dig in, and hopefully we have your contact information if people would like to follow up with you. Okay, thank you. So I don't want to short shrift the Oregon Foster Child Care update. We've got people that have come from very far away. So we're going to have Representative Stark kick it off for us. And I think Deborah Scholem, is that her?
Scholem. Yes. Thank you.
Chair Kenny Geyer. My name is Dwayne Stark, State Representative, House District 4, for the record, and I'm pleased to introduce not quite a constituent of mine, but a friend from Southern Oregon. She round trip. By the time she gets back, she will have traveled 450 miles to come talk to you guys for about 10 minutes, hopefully 10 minutes, maybe 5. So in 2015, Chip Shields organized a series of town halls throughout the state and with foster parents. And it was interesting the amount of feedback that we got. And so my staff and I had an opportunity to participate in a few of those. One of them was down in Jackson County. And I was really pleased that as foster parents started voicing some of their concerns in the system, and as if you've been paying attention to the media, we have a huge shortage of foster parents right now and a shortage of beds, and it's declining. So I was appreciative that Jackson County Foster Parent Association grabbed onto that, you know, kind of the momentum there, and decided, what can we do to figure out what's going on? Why are the parents having this tough time? What questions can we ask? So a couple other groups have also done surveys on OLIS, OJD, you know, the Citizen Review Board. They had planned on being here, couldn't make it, but they had a survey that they did. Great results. You guys can read that on OLIS. DHS currently has a survey that's ongoing right now out in the field. And Deborah Scholem introduced, with the Jackson County Foster Parents Association, introduced a survey that she's going to give us some results on today. I want to tell you briefly how I got to know her. So if you remember, in 2015, we passed Senate Bill 741, which was intended to give DHS more options to allow exemptions and allow foster parents the ability to adopt children when they've been in their homes for quite a while. Well, February of 2016, I received a call from Deborah, our office did, because unintentionally, to my belief, is that there was somewhat of an error about how that rule was actually implemented. We intended to create more options, and the way that rule was implemented actually cut some of the existing options for exceptions that would normally be made to allow foster parents to adopt. I was very appreciative. Director Psyche, you know, we got him on the line. He was new in the role and came right in and immediately addressed the issue to reinstate some of the exemptions that had been removed through a miscommunication. And through that process, I got to know Deborah and her situation. So she can tell you more about her situation and give you an update on the survey. And I'm going to go sit back there in case I have questions.
Thank you, Representative Stark. So yes, 2 years ago I became a foster parent. I'll tell you a little bit about my journey, and then I will delve into our survey. Little boy came just as they do, nothing but the clothes on his back.
Oh, could you just say your name for the record, even though he
Deborah
introduced...
Deborah Scholem.
Thank you.
Yes. And so we went through the process. In foster care, there's many transitions. Children go back to biological relatives. They come back into our care. So as Representative Stark mentioned, that's how I got to know him, because there was a 12 consecutive month clause that didn't allow for me to adopt my little boy once that situation came up. Thanks to Director Psyche and Representative Stark's working together, I adopted my son on Friday.
So, congratulations.
And I have the photo up there in the right-hand corner. That's my family, my birth daughter on the left there, and my foster, now adoptive, son on the right. So this is actually really great timing for me, because I just saw how working together, the legislator and DHS and foster parents, can create this wonderful stability for these kids. So I worked with the Jackson County Foster Parent Association and also with a discussion group that I helped to start in Jackson County, where we look at these various issues currently facing foster care. And we put together a survey that went statewide through the other foster parent associations. And so today I want to share a little bit about what we as foster parents think could be done to solve this crisis, because yes, foster parents are dropping out, and we need to retain those that are currently in the system while also finding new foster homes so that we can meet these needs. So I just want to talk a little bit about foster parents and what we do. I think a lot of people don't realize we go through intensive training. We are essentially foster, we are professional volunteer parents. We commit to taking care of these kids' emotional, behavioral, health needs. We are the ones that take them to doctor's appointments and therapists. We're oftentimes supervising visitation with biological parents. So we get a really complete picture of these kids, and we put in so much. We put in our time, our love. We sacrifice time with our biological family so that we can be here for these children. We do it because we care. Unfortunately, so many of us feel, and this was really prominent throughout the survey, that we're just not included. We're not a valued part of the foster care team. We have no say in policy as far as what happens with these kids. There's nothing there. We have no input. Permanency plans are made by caseworkers that oftentimes have only met the child a few times. Here we are, you know, professional trained parents, and we still have nothing to say. This causes a lot of burnout. We want these kids to have stable, healthy lives and futures. And as the people who know them best, we would like to be able to have a say in that. So that kind of gives you a little bit of an idea about what we do as foster parents. So why do foster parents quit? This is a big question that we've been asking around the state. We were trying to solve this, you know, why do they quit and what can we do about it? So a lot of foster parents feel they're not part of the team. 70% feel that they're only sometimes or never a part of their foster child's team. So that's something that needs to change. If you only have 30% feeling like they have any say in things, why should we keep going? We've got, you can see from the statistics that I've put up there, you know, over half of people feel that we're not well informed of the case plan, of what's happening with these children that are in our homes. We're kind of the last people to know. We are. We're the last people to know what's going to happen to our kids. They can be taken from one moment to the next. Oftentimes after years. You know, we're here for these kids for years on end, and we have no part in what's happening. So, so we also feel like we have no rights and that we're not given enough information about the rights that foster parents have. So a few things that we feel as foster parents that would increase retention of foster parents would be better communication with DHS. This often goes through caseworkers, certifiers. There's a variety of personnel that work with DHS, but being kept more in the loop, that's one part. And then being made a part of the child's legal decision-making team. When these big moments come up where it is decided, is this child going to go back to a biological parent? Is this child going to move to an adoption plan? We would like to, just like ACASA is allowed to have some input on this, we would also like to have an input in what happens to these kids based on our varied and extensive experience with the children. Financial assistance. Currently, we spend significant amounts of money out of pocket on each child. There's two problems to that. The one is, okay, we're volunteers, and we're putting in so much financially. The other part is, for some of us, it makes it impossible to be foster parents. So you've got great quality people who would want to, because they care about these children, that just can't afford to be foster parents. If you're a working parent, like me, you're looking at paying daycare for your child. That's the stipend that we currently receive. It's gone. The rest is all out of pocket. As some of you might know, diapers and food and all these costs associated, plus transporting the kids to visits, it's all a part of the financial. So foster parents feel very sensitively around this topic because we never ever want to be seen as wanting to be paid, but it would be nice to have the basic needs of a child covered. And then, yes, most importantly maybe, we want to see that children come first, not the biological parents. Sometimes these cases get dragged on for years. No stability for these kids. They go back and forth and back and forth. Now, there are laws that mandate that there are guidelines and timelines, but if a parent starts making a bit of progress pretty quickly, they get another chance. So we want to see that children really come first, because they're the ones that can't speak for themselves. They're the ones that can't protect themselves. Biological parents have choices. They're adults. They can make their own life choices. Children can't. They're in our hands. So I'm going to speak briefly about working with caseworkers. There's a lot of negativity currently in the system on the foster parent end about working with caseworkers. We are scared of caseworkers because they are the only and sole decision maker. Oftentimes, even the judge has nothing to say. The caseworker makes the choice. So we are terrified of retribution, and you can see that from the statistic. You know, there is a significant amount. Only 10% of people reported that they have no fear of reporting a caseworker. This needs to change. There has to be a safe way for foster parents to step forward and say, okay, this isn't working. This, you know, there's something going on here. And things do go on. I've seen that from our discussion group. There are so many times where what the caseworkers do just doesn't even fit with what they're supposed to be doing. And we know the rules. We've read them. But we can't go anywhere. A lot of foster parents say they go to the supervisor. It doesn't go anywhere. So again, this is something where there needs to be a place for them to go where they get safe help. And I believe there's a foster care ombudsman currently in the workings.
Foster care parents.
So, ombudsman. Yes. So I'm excited to hear that. That'll at least be a resource that foster parents can go to. Next, yeah. So there's two critical times in foster family life. They're kind of the make or break times for foster families. When your child initially comes to your home, everything kind of goes upside down for a little while. They're adjusting, you're adjusting. They frequently have behaviors that they come with that, you know, don't fit into your family unit. So during that initial placement, we need to know as much information as possible. We need to know about the child's background, about their medical needs, their behavioral challenges, just anything that caseworkers could give us. We need to know that at placement, and that's not happening. Oftentimes, we're not even receiving placement papers at the time of placement, much less information about the child. I was told my son has no medical needs. 5 days later, we're at the ER with a life-threatening emergency. 10 days later, again, no medical needs. He'd been in the care system before. It's all documented. It's all there. Where's that information at? Why didn't I receive it? And this is just my story. I've heard the same thing from so many people. So there needs to be better communication of information. Then there's when the foster child leaves. This is a very traumatizing time. It's we love these kids as our own. And we know that there's a good chance they're going to go at some point. And we're supporting that. We want them to be with their biological families if those families are capable of providing good homes. But that doesn't change the fact that we love them and that they've been a part of our family. And these kids are ripped away from us from one moment to the next.
We don't know what happens to them. They're just taken. And I know so many wonderful foster parents who have been through this, and I went through it too with my son. He came back, and I'm one of the lucky ones. But so many foster parents do not know where their children that they've loved, that they've given so much to, have gone. Why aren't there child updates? Why is there a confidentiality clause that says that 2 months later, if you call that caseworker, they can't say anything to you about what's going on with that child? There should be phone calls following up. You want to keep foster parents? Let them know that the kids they loved aren't just gone. Follow up with them. I think this is, I mean, over 90% of people said they would like to have child updates. This is huge, because people drop out when their hearts are so broken that they can't possibly take any more. And one way to start healing that is by letting foster parents know that their value doesn't end at the moment that child leaves their home. They're still a valued member of that foster child's team. They're still somebody that counts. And I think that's huge. And yeah, again, back to this, you know, ultimately, policy and laws should focus on the best interest of the child. Children shouldn't have to wait for years in care. They shouldn't have to be moved back and forth. They should have stable homes, loving homes. And I know that there's been a lot of wonderful work done for this, and there's still a lot to get done to make this really happen. And what you'll see is, once foster parents, current foster parents, feel valued and like they're part of that decision-making team, they're going to be recruiting other foster parents. It's hard to do when your heart is broken and you feel like you have no voice. But once you do feel like you're a valued part of this child's team, you're going to be bringing in your friends and other family members. So I think that's the solution that foster parents have come to.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any questions? We have another panel of foster parents coming up. Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Very powerfully articulated. So next, Rosemary Jernigan, David Mulick, and Donna Bowman, and Ryan Fisher. Did you want to join them?
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, my name is Ryan Fisher. I'm just going to say a few brief words at the beginning, and then I'll have a few more to say at the end. But I just wanted to set the stage for the testimony that you're about to hear. Many of you know that I represent the Community Action Partnership of Oregon, which is the statewide association of community action agencies. You heard from Rose earlier, who is the director of the Community Action Agency in Multnomah County. I'm excited because I had a chance to work with Community Action Partnership in a different role. Community Action received a grant from the Meyer Memorial Trust to work with two pilots, one in Klamath County and one in Jackson County. And what you're about to hear are reports from both of those pilots. And when I return at the end, I'll also provide some of the recommendations that Meyer has asked us to put together. And this work is still ongoing, and so these are just some of the first ones that have surfaced. But I'm excited for you to hear these stories.
Great. Chair Kenny Geyer, and members of the committee. My name is Rosemary Jernigan. I hold a program manager position for the Office of Self-Sufficiency. Thank you for having me.
Maybe you can put that mic a little bit closer to you.
I was asked today to share with you how our program began. It really began from the individuals that were in residential treatment for drug and alcohol addiction, wanting to better their lives and become productive citizens. These families have been on TANF and also involved in the child welfare program. And they were coming out of residential with no place to go, no housing, and some obstacles in their past that hindered their ability to find adequate and safe housing for their families. We heard their voices and wanted to do something about that. Part of that is really recognizing that my community in Southern Oregon has strong, innovative leaders that really do have a heart for the work and want to help. And so we came together as a group to reflect on what was being shared with us and really recognizing that we had a crisis when it came to housing. And so in partnership with child welfare, self-sufficiency, some of our CCO partners, and the Community Action Partnership, Access and Housing, the Housing of Jackson County, we decided to come up with a program called the Bridges Program to really help people stabilize in housing with some one-on-one case management. And what we did is we really looked at funding sources and recognized that we alone didn't have the monies available to help families, but if we all put in a little, that we could be really collaborative in our approach. And so we have done that.
Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee, my name is David Mulig, and I'm the Director of Support Services at Access, which is the community action agency in Jackson County. And we were one of the individuals at the table at the very beginning, because we have had many, many years of working with our homeless population, our at-risk population, really to help avoid individuals and families finding themselves on the street or remaining on the streets. And much of our funding has come from the Oregon Housing and Community Services, which we heard from earlier today. But we also have the Support Services for Veterans Family grant, which is now housing our veterans in Jackson County. So we have many years of working with helping stabilize families and individuals and their rental homes. For example, last year we helped about 450 individuals in Jackson County. So it's a pretty large group of people. We came together with this team because we had the expertise in doing some really intensive case management with our families and individuals. And part of this opportunity working with DHS and some of the funding that they've shared with us at Access also allowed us to change the case management model to also a peer mentor model and also to do landlord engagement. So not only do we do our in-depth case management, but we find people in those roles as case managers who have had life experience is similar to some of those who are coming out of a treatment center. And also, part of this is really important because our housing stock in Jackson County is extremely low. It's less than 1%. So we needed someone who could also go out and engage our landlords and help them understand that we have families that might have a lot of really high barriers, but we're here to help you, and we're really coming in and doing our best to help them be successful. A couple of other things that I just wanted to kind of mention. What's really also, I think, is really special about being a community action agency at Access is that we can actually blend a lot of different funding together. So we receive funding from DHS to help support having our case manager, which is an Access employee. And we also are able to tap into the OHCS funds, which again brings in the rental subsidies, the deposit assistance, and some other assistance to help some of the families that are being identified and being referred to us. But at the same time, and I believe Ryan mentioned this, is that we also received a Meyer Memorial grant. And what we can do with that grant is it's very unrestricted. So where we have eligibility requirements for a lot of our programming, Meyer Memorial gives us the opportunity. They said, you know what, we know you have families with barriers. We know you have restrictions. Please use this money, you know, increase the rents, increase the deposits, pet deposits, whatever it is, because they understand that it's really important that our families be successful. We've learned a lot. We're still learning quite a bit about how do we partner with a bunch of various agencies with different perspectives on how to work with our families. Just a quick example of one of the things I think has been very successful is having a case manager going into a home on a regular basis. We have the opportunity to ask questions and look for red flags where someone in the family might be potentially relapsing or coming close to relapsing. And if we find there's a red flag, we can call the group together, you know, that have been working with this family way ahead of time to create a system of care to do our best to make sure that that family stays stabilized. So again, there's so many stories and so many opportunities, but this relationship and this ability to work together has really helped 31 families in Jackson County. We've only had, I think, three that weren't successful, but we have six who are graduating in the next few months because they've shown to be stabilized and able to be self-sufficient on their own. So thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. So, Chair Kinigeyer and committee members, thank you for having me here today. My name is Donna Bowman, and I'm the director for the Community Action Program in Klamath and Lake Counties. So we're down in the very rural areas. We do a lot of programs that were talked about today with housing. We do long-term housing assistance, short-term housing assistance, with the funding streams that we've already talked about. We are very, community action agencies are very community-driven, so we have other programs that we do as well that you're not going to see in other areas. Our role in this grant, the Systems Alignment Grant, was using our family development team, and we have a contract with our DHS office, one with self-sufficiency, which is the Family Support and Connections Program, and then we also have some of the SPUR funding, and we act as navigators for some of our families in the community. These are families who are at risk of losing their children or have possibly already lost their children. And what we focused on with this grant was really looking at housing. Again, we're filling that housing crisis around the state. We have a less than 1% housing availability for our families. But what we did is we really wanted to find out what are the true barriers for housing. And we done a lot of work with family development, doing more than your usual intake with these families. We've been working with them in depth. We have 11 families we've been working with, establishing trust and being able to ask questions. So we went back in their history. We went back to say, how long have you been homeless over a longer period of time, and what are those barriers? And so we were gathering information on barriers that come from within the family, drug and alcohol, mental health issues, and then we also looked at barriers in the community where the systems are all working together to align, or in some cases, I'll be honest with you, they don't align very well. So those are some of the things that we're gathering information for this project. We've developed, what was interesting is out of the 11 families that we picked out of our group, a variety, nine of those families have over time revealed to us that they've been homeless as children as well. So it was getting that extra information that we needed to find out what's going on. So we're compiling a bunch of information on all of our families. I hope at some point that somebody's able to look at all that information, because it's really got some really good stuff as far as what are those barriers for families, what are the barriers in the community, and what we can do moving forward, aligning our systems so that we make it easier for families not to be homeless.
Thank you so much. Thank you for coming from so far away, too.
Are there any questions?
Well, I would love to hear more about those barriers. I'm sure you can use Ryan as your conduit.
Yes.
Sounds like mental health and addiction. There may be disabilities. I know we had a general assistance program that we're hoping to continue to make sure that there's some funding for people so they don't become homeless, or if they already are homeless. Certainly the stock, making sure that we have the stock, because how are all families going to find a place to rent, the families you serve and the other families, if we don't have enough? So it absolutely does always come back to that. We've got to get the stock of affordable housing up. But thank you for all you do, because it's not just the roof over the head. It's the support that you give. And thank you so much for your work. And
you.
Please continue to help inform us on what you think the priorities are as we go forward.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Michelle Rudzinski.
Chair Kinigeyer and members of the committee, my name is Michelle Rudzinski. I'm the
co-founder and executive director of Spoon. Spoon is a Portland-based nonprofit. Our mission is to transform the nutrition and feeding for children living outside of permanent family care. So traditionally, we've worked in orphanages overseas with children who are not cared for by families, and we have found alarming rates of malnutrition in that population of children. The more we worked with them and the more we studied this issue, the more we realized that the malnutrition in these children was due less to the low resources of the countries where they live and more to the fact that they're living without families and without consistent caregivers or parents to advocate for them. So once that became apparent to us, we started to wonder if the same issues existed for children living in U.S. foster care right here in our own backyard. And they do. Children enter foster care at a disadvantage due to early adverse childhood experiences like poor prenatal and infant care, food insecurity, chronic stress, drug and alcohol exposure, effects of abuse and neglect. So as a result, they're at risk for poor outcomes overall, and in particular, and including in the area of nutrition. And also because of these early adverse experiences, they have difficulties with trust and attachment, and so they have difficulty establishing that responsive feeding relationship with caregivers. So it makes challenges around food very common in this population, resulting in disrupted regulation of food intake, so eating too much or too little, poor growth, and poor nutritional outcomes. And this is something that doesn't only impact them in childhood, but throughout their lives. So Spoon started partnering with DHS 2 years ago, and we started out by conducting a survey and some focus groups of DHS caseworkers and foster parents. And we found that 49% of caseworkers reported that feeding and nutrition issues are a common problem for foster families. And similarly, 49% of foster parents reported for caring for one or more foster child who had a feeding or nutrition issue. And some of the typical feeding issues included selective eating, where kids will only eat very familiar foods or only one texture and have difficulty transitioning to new textures. Overstuffing, where this is not an uncommon issue. Children will stuff their mouths so much that they gag and vomit back on the plate. They will hoard food maybe in their bedrooms based on history of food insecurity. They'll kind of save food for later when they think they might need it. They may have poor oral skills, difficulty chewing, difficulty swallowing, which can lead to aspiration. Food and liquid can get in their lungs and cause pneumonia or upper respiratory infections. So these aren't always minor feeding issues. They can become debilitating to the children and consequently to the families caring for them. And then they contribute to poor growth and obesity. So some of the growth issues we see in foster children are stunting, which is significantly short height for their age. And this is important because it impacts their cognition, their school performance, and even into adulthood, job performance, and it's preventable. You also will see high rates of underweight, but also overweight and obesity. Up to 44% of children in foster care are obese, and the reasons for that are sometimes different than the general population, and it has to do with those early adverse experiences and the dysregulated eating. But whether underweight or overweight, the research suggests that foster children are frequently malnourished at entry into care. Unfortunately, the data on micronutrient deficiencies is very scarce. These issues have not been well studied in foster children, but one area that has been studied is iron deficiency, which can lead to anemia. Studies have shown that anemia prevalence in children in foster care younger than 6 years old is twice that for children younger than six who live with families. And like stunting, this is important because it impacts them throughout their lives. Children who become anemic at a young age when their brain is developing, have decreased IQ, poor school performance, and it can last into adulthood with poor job performance. And anemia, this anemia is due to a combination of poor diet and also high levels of stress. And then another interesting nutrient deficiency to be aware of is something that happens around ketchup growth. So when children are placed from foster care into permanent families, whether it's a permanent foster family, back to their biological family, or into an adoptive family, they often grow rapidly. And that's good, and we want that. And they grow oftentimes because they're getting love and attention consistently for the first time. And it takes love and attention to grow. And they're growing fast because they're getting a good diet, a good consistent diet. But one thing that happens when children grow rapidly like that is that they become more malnourished. So even a lot of pediatricians don't know this. You think a child is being placed into a good environment, they should be healthy, but they're becoming increasingly malnourished because due to that rapid growth, their body is pulling on their nutrient stores, which, as I mentioned earlier, are depleted. So the body is pulling on these depleted stores to grow fast, and so the children become more malnourished. So because of all these findings, Spoon and DHS partnered and developed a training program in nutrition and feeding for caseworkers and foster parents. We developed a training curriculum and delivered customized trainings to the foster parents and professionals that specifically address these unique needs. And in addition to addressing needs these children and families have right now, the trainings seek to prevent long-term problems for these children going forward. It's a great start, but gaps still exist. There are several important elements needed for a comprehensive program. First of all, research is needed to fully understand the nutrition and feeding needs of foster children. Like I mentioned, research in this area is scant. And then we need careful nutrition screening of children upon entry into foster care. We need the development of trauma-informed, individualized intervention plans to address the unique needs of each foster child. We need a way to get the training to as many professionals and foster parents as possible. Attending classroom trainings can be tricky for foster parents who are already stretched thin, so we need to work on platforms for training, perhaps computer-based, that are more cost-effective and convenient for families. And last, we need a way to continually monitor the nutritional status of children, not only at placement, but for months and even years to come. So we at Spoon look forward to continuing to update you and working with you to create solutions that will increase the capacity of DHS caseworkers and foster parents in the area of nutrition and feeding that will ultimately improve the development and quality of life of foster children. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments? I'll just add that, you know, one of my three children was a very picky eater, and that caused a lot of stress for him and for us. And you think about the amount of stress it is for children coming into a household and trying to adjust, and they may have come from a very different diet. And so it's, you know, I'm thinking about not just the lack of nutrients that might happen, but just the level of stress that happens around the mealtime. And then you throw into that different cultures, you know, totally different diets. So a quick question, do you do anything with trying to train caregivers or foster families on how to adapt different diets, or is DHS now starting to look more at that kind of cultural competency when they're seeing what's a good fit for the child?
Well, that's definitely part of our training, is teaching foster parents how to respond to children. First of all, why children may react the way they do, which is exactly what you said. They may be coming from a totally different food culture. Mm-hmm. They may be experiencing food for the first time they've never seen, and there may be different expectations with what they're supposed to do at mealtime. Some kids may be able to wander around. Some kids have to sit and finish every bite. And so you see a lot of behaviors around that, and then stress in the families. Mm-hmm. So we train the families how to respond to that. Mm-hmm. And ideally, if all families were trained, they'd all be responding consistently, and so the children would be getting the same message.
Right. Okay, big challenge. Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah. You mentioned that you guys also do international work. Just would love to touch base with you on that as well. I just returned Saturday from Uganda, where we have an NGO that I oversee over there working with orphans. And so would love to hear about your work there, but probably not in this context, I guess.
Yes, I'd be happy to share anytime.
That's great. Thank you so much.
Thank you,
Michelle. Okay, so last on this particular issue area, we have Clyde Psyche, Director of DHS, and Lena Al-Husseini, who is now officially on board. And what would be great is if you have any kind of comments that you'd like to say about some of the panels that you've heard,
very just brief. I know that this you've been under the microscope in this particular area. Again, we don't have a lot of time, and we do have more opportunities to see much more of you, but just very brief highlight.
Yeah. So Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Stark, Vice Chair Peluso, members of the committee, for the record, Clyde Psyche, Department of Human Services, and I'm very confident that I'll be spending a lot of time with you come January, February, so we will be brief. With me at the table is Lena Al-Husseini, who is our new Child Welfare Director. She started on November 7th, if I remember correctly. And I wanted her to just kind of share some initial thoughts and observations with you and then talk about kind of what some of her priorities are going to be moving forward. And Nathan Ricks is our director for executive projects. When I came and talked to you and spoke with you in September, I talked about the fact that we were going to be developing a project plan for child welfare program improvement that came out of the governor's independent assessment. And Nathan is the person who's going to be in charge of that. And so I wanted him to share with you kind of his initial observations and already some of the planning that he's done. And Nathan joined us on November 28th, so he's fairly new also. Just a couple of observations. You know, first of all, listening to Director Salazar, prior to her arriving in Oregon, we had reached out to Housing and Community Services and had really begun or talked about a series of regular meetings with the executive teams because we really think there's a very strong connection. And that kind of came out of an experience we had with the Department of Veterans Affairs. We had Director Smith had approached me, and we had got together and talked about kind of the crossover clients we have. We have some veterans who are clients of the department who oftentimes aren't even aware that they're eligible for veterans benefits, and oftentimes the benefits they get from veteran services are more robust and much better than the benefits they get from us. So we've partnered with them and kind of developed a system in which we're cross-matching their lists and our lists, and already have been able to reach out to some veterans and been able to get them into a much better financial situation than they were previously. And it's just pretty amazing that some of these veterans who have been in service to the country feel that they're or don't even know they're entitled to benefits. So that actually has been a very good project for us. Listening to Deborah's presentation on foster parents, some of the information she shared is information that we have been aware of. She also, I think, brought forth some new pieces of information. Lena and Nathan and I are actually scheduled to meet with her tomorrow. To have a more in-depth conversation about the survey and what she found and really talk about ways we can improve the relationship with foster parents. I know at least one issue she raised about foster parent reimbursement rate, which we haven't raised in a number of years, and we in working with the governor's office, have a package in the governor's recommended budget to try to bring foster parent rates up, which I think is a pretty critical piece. So there were a number of things I was going to touch base with you on, but I think what I really want to do is have Lena and Nathan be able to speak with you, and some of these other things I can talk about later. But I did want to kind of point out when we came to talk to you in September, both Representative Evans, Representative Bueller, and I believe Representative Stark talked about metrics and how we were measuring our progress or lack thereof. And so I had, with the help of Ms. Ross, distributed a handout earlier, and it looks like this. And what this handout represents is what we call our Tier 1 performance measures. And these are performance measures at a department level, so the highest kind of level within the department. We also have Tier 2 measures, which are the program measures specific to aging and people with disabilities, child welfare. And then we actually have a tier three, which are programs within the program. So in for instance, adoptions within child welfare. They have also other measures that they use. And, you know, it's still a work in progress. One of the things that happened is when I came into DHS, I asked our program directors, our five program directors, so I know you have tier two measures. How often do you look at those measures? And we meet quarterly on this. And the answer I received from our program directors is, well, we look at them quarterly, probably 2 weeks before we know we're going to have to report out to them. So for me, that was just the indicator that these were not the right things. Because if we have the right measures, what you're really doing is looking at them at least on a weekly basis to tell whether or not you're making progress or to know whether or not you need to make adjustments. So we have actually spent the last 10 months going back and re-examining all our tier two measures in the five program areas. And I think we're to a place right now where I'm fairly comfortable that we are looking at the right things. We still have a few minor tweaks to do, but once we finalize that, we're going to post it on our website so people can see them anytime they want to. What we will then do is really take a look at the tier two measures and how they relate to these department measures and make sure there's a good line of sight between the program measures and the department measures. So be happy to come back and talk to the committee more about that. But I just, since we kind of started that discussion in September, I wanted to make sure that I shared this information with you. And so with that, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Al-Husseini. And
Representative Parrish has a question about your scorecard.
Sure.
So this is helpful. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Do you have something, or are you planning on something like this for not just on like sort of the safety outcome side, but on the helping families get their side? And the question kind of more relates to talking with somebody who's been through like the classes that you have to take to become a foster parent and then has not heard back from DHS and completed those like in September, October, and it's December. Like, are we tracking how well we're moving families who want to be foster parents through? Because I don't know what all the steps are, but it's I would hope that we're progressing those people quickly and monitoring the success rate of progressing people quickly and connecting them to kids.
Yeah. Chair Kenny-Geyer, Vice Chair Stark, and Vice Chair Peluso, we are looking at that at kind of the tier two level, not the department level. And we have not just measures specific to foster care, but also to customer satisfaction, so to speak. So trying to gather some of the data that Deborah gathered in her survey on an ongoing basis so we can gauge how well we're doing in supporting and registering and foster parents. But that's kind of at the tier two level as opposed to the tier one.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You bet.
Representative Buehler.
Yeah, Clyde, this is really good. Don't be discouraged if some of them, you know, aren't that actionable. You know, that it's a process, right? And you know, you have to find those right smart metrics, and that takes time and they change. You know, but I think this is a really good start, and I'm glad you're taking this approach.
Yeah. So, Vice Chair Kenny-Geyer, Chair Kenny-Geyer, Vice Chair Stark, and Peluso, I appreciate that, Representative Buehler, and we know this isn't something you can just do once and say, okay, now we're done. This is something that is a constant, ongoing body of work, and we need to be, you know, really examining on a continual basis. Are we measuring the right things, and are they telling us what they should be telling us so that we can manage the organization in the right way?
So I agree, and this is builds on the conversation that we had a few months ago. I'm not sure which hearing, where we talked about the dashboard that you wanted to make that, put that transparent, have it on the website where people could see the kinds of things you're measuring, and so people can have input and at a future time, because we don't have time now, I'd love to know who's involved in that. What kind of advisory groups do you have? How do you kind of solicit information about that? And what are the things that you're thinking of adding, and what are in the Tier 2 and 3? So no time to get into detail, but it is great to see that you're actually putting into action something that you talked about with us several months ago. It's a good start. Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to do two things if I could. I'd like to, number one, say thank you for getting back on the metrics and simple, concise, clear, looking at them often, very good for Air Force guy like me that needs simple pictures. So that's good. The other thing I'd like to say is, we, if it's all right, to say that Undersecretary Kincannon is here from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. As the director knows, he used to be the director of DHS, so it's fitting that he's here at this point.
Yes.
And we had the great honor of having the secretary to Central High School. I'm going to brag on my school district for a little bit for the after-school program. They were recognized, and the secretary came out and basically talked to the kids and the folks putting that on, and just a real big plug for the things that are being done at an innovative level and the wraparound services for our young ones. So thank you for being here today, and thank you for the metrics. I'm looking forward to following up.
So and just one quick comment.
I want to welcome you to the room, and I hear that you may be coming to my district to see the after-school meal program as well. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yes, we're up in Douglas area today.
Okay, great.
Cover school, doing great things.
Great. Thank you.
So just a real quick comment, Chair Kitty Geyer, is that I actually worked for Director Kincannon when he was the director of DHS. So it's really good to see him, and we're actually going to get a chance to visit after the hearing. So.
That's great. Well, we will try to not hold you too long.
Okay. Nina.
Okay. Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Peluso, Vice Chair Stark, members of the committee. My name is Dina Al-Husseini, and I'm the Director of Child Welfare Programs for DHS. I'm really excited to be here and honored to have this opportunity to serve Oregon's children and families. So it's been 13 days. I can tell you one thing. We have a lot of work to do, but I think there's I'm very lucky. Director Stike has really sort of done a lot of work to help me do my job better. So I'm really benefiting from all the work they've done beforehand and all the information that they've collected. We have a lot of, we have strengths. I mean, there's some good news. I am surrounded by an executive team that is really committed and wants to see change and wants to work within the system. I have staff, 2,600 staff, most of which really want to serve the children of Oregon and are encumbered by the system and by different bureaucratic things happening. They're siloed from each other. So there's a lot for us to look at. The system has been reactive. It wasn't thought through in a seamless way. So, you know, if I was a mother and a child standing at your door, I kind of want to see how their journey is within DHS. And I think it makes it easier for us to have accountability and oversight if it's clear from the top. And also it's easier for our caseworkers and for everyone in DHS to provide a good service. So that's one of the strengths I see. You know, we have issues with, as I mentioned, the system is, it really needs to be looked at and has to be streamlined and rethought. It has to have input from community. We heard now from the foster parents. I mean, for them not to feel they're included, that's very a grave matter to me, and that we should really consider. I think we need to include community. We need to include stakeholders at every level. We shouldn't be so siloed, and I think that's another thing I'm going to be looking at. Training. For our staff, I don't know how much time I have, but we
are very short.
Very short.
You'll be back.
Yes.
I'd like to standardize our service delivery in all our district offices. Sometimes it seems like if you go to one district, you get a different kind of service from another district. But the first thing I'd really like to do, and I've used this word with Director Saki, I feel like our district offices are like almost hemorrhaging for lack of resources and support. The first thing I'd like to do is realign some of our resources to serve them, so you have enough people on the ground that can do the work properly. If I'm a child, if I'm a caseworker and I have 18 cases on my hand, It's a liability for us as at DHS, and it's not good for the children and the families that we serve. So that's the first thing I'd like to do, is look at their needs and address that. And then look through strategically from a macro and a micro level at how we can best align with all the work that Director Psyche has done. We have an opportunity now coming up because we have the, and I'm used to the acronyms now, but I'm going to read it out, the Federal Child and Safety Services Review, along with the Program Improvement Plans, which Nathan will be leading the DHS Unified Improvement Plan. And that goes back to the metrics and the data. We have to be informed by data. So I think this is an opportunity for that, to collect data and sort of start tracking where we are. And I think that's basically the overview. I have a lot more to say, so I can take another hour. I'm sure over the next few months we can talk a lot more about that. But I think, you know, the biggest strength we have staff who are committed, and I think we need to be inclusive of their voice. And we have a community that wants to be active, and I think we need to include them as well. And I think that's been lacking a little bit in the past.
Thank you.
Nathan.
Chair Representative Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. Again, my name is Nathan Ricks, Director of Executive Projects. I am a little over 2 weeks here at DHS. I'm looking forward to the challenge of creating the Unified Safety Implementation Plan. I want to do three things very quickly and concisely today. First, I want to introduce myself, tell you a little bit about who I am, describe the plan in a little detail, and then I'll tell you what my 30-day action plan is, because we do have a lot of work to get started on. So first, while I'm new to state government, I'm new to DHS, I'm not new to state government. I spent the last 2 years working with the team at the Liquor Control Commission, setting up the rules and regulations for businesses entering into the recreational marijuana market. And before that, I ran statewide business improvement projects at the Department of Administrative Services. So I'm really looking forward to this internal change that's already started. And I welcome contact and questions about any of the material that I'll talk about today. So first, in constructing the Unified Child Safety Implementation Plan, we're going to require some dedicated analysis to data, to organizational change, finances, the way our rules are written. Lena just said, we do have multiple departments working on specific issues, but we do need to broaden our approach and look at what rules can be streamlined, standardized, so that the outcome is one that protects children all the way across the agency. We're going to have timelines associated with each one of the work streams so that we're able to track exactly when we're beginning a project and ending it. We'll be staffing the plan with a dedicated group of project managers that have expertise in the aforementioned areas. The real basis of the report is on the Child Safety Independent Review that was conducted by Public Knowledge. So we'll be using that as our platform, and then integrating in many other reports that the agency's received over the past 5 to 10 years, including but not limited to our CERT reviews, the BRS comprehensive report that was completed in 2005, the CFRS report that Lena mentioned. And in the next 30 days, my plan is to begin synthesizing all of those reports into the final implementation plan, begin to onboard the staff to actually launch the work streams to do the work, and then establish a steering team made of outside provider members, other experts in the field that can help navigate this course as we set it. So like I said, thank you for the warm welcome, and please consider me your Google on any questions related to the improvement plan.
Great. Thank you. Any questions, comments? Great. Thank you so much. That wraps up our Oregon Foster Child update. But Director Psyche, if you could stay and kick us off on the memory long-term care. It's another issue that this committee has been looking at. And Ashley Carson Cunningham, thank you for joining him. So as you all remember, we had a bill that was introduced by Representative Caddy McEwen in February. It did not result, it did not pass as a formal task force, but Representative McEwen and I led an informal task force that that reviewed some of the issue areas that you heard about in testimony here, and that has evolved into a Purple Ribbon Commission, which you will be hearing about after these two. So you can just kick us off and tell us you're not waiting for commission recommendations to go about and do a lot of the work to make sure that our seniors, particularly those in memory care that are very vulnerable, have the adequate oversight and staffing and support, and that the facilities that are providing support to them also have the opportunity for good quality training and workforce and all the things that are going to help protect people. So please catch us up on what you've been doing over the last few months, what the challenges are, and what you've been doing about that.
Sure. So Chair Kinnegayer, Vice Chair Stark, Vice Chair Peluso, members of the committee, again, for the record, Clyde Psyche, Department of Human Services. And, you know, since I've been here, a lot of attention has really been directed towards safety of children, and rightly so. But really, our focus has been not just on safety to children, but safety to all the vulnerable populations we serve. So it's really about safety for children, safety for seniors, safety for people with developmental and physical disabilities. So it's really been kind of an overarching focus and not just directed at children. And Ashley, I think, has really stepped up and been a real leader in ensuring that we are making advances in the area of safety for seniors and people with physical disabilities. She and her staff have done yeoman's work. I will share with you that some of the reports that I've seen have been really difficult to read and have really made an impact on me. And while we have the majority of our providers who are very well-intentioned and work really hard and provide good service, that's not true across the board. And it's really our responsibility to ferret out the ones that are not providing appropriate service and to make sure. Ashley and I often have the conversation of, so would we want our mother or father to be in this facility? And that's the lens we try to look through. So let me turn it over to Ashley and have her talk about some of the work she's been doing and would like to do.
Thank you, Director Psyche. Good afternoon, Chair Kinnegayer, Vice Chairs Peluso and Stark, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ashley Carson Cottingham. I'm the Director for Aging and People with Disabilities at DHS. I really appreciate the opportunity to come here today to present to you about some of the things that we've been doing in our licensing arena. Just quickly, our foundational statute for our program, we really believe that Oregonians deserve to live in a safe environment free from neglect, abuse, and financial exploitation, and that every Oregonian has the right to live as independently as possible with dignity, choice, and self-determination. And we are faced with a growing aging population, and our citizens really need high quality services and supports. We are also faced with serving more and more people with Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia. I believe DHS is prepared to rise to this challenge. We have a lot of expertise internally, and we want to meet Oregonians' needs to the best of our ability and to the full extent allowed within our scope as a state agency. Just quickly, this is our programmatic for aging and people with disabilities vision statement and our goals. We've done a lot of work, as Director Psyche mentioned, around making sure that we are looking at our programmatic goals and then that we have appropriate measures related to those goals to track whether or not we're reaching some of those goals. And that progress has happened over the course of the year. We still have a ways to go, but I feel like we're getting to a point where I'm going to be able to track that progress a lot more carefully. As far as our work in licensing, I think that APD can and must improve aspects of our licensing and adult protective services functions to better serve older adults and people with disabilities. Our providers, as Clyde mentioned, are entrusted to care for very vulnerable people. And it's important that they are meeting those resident needs. and that there is an emphasis on safety and quality of those services. It is our responsibility, though, as a state agency to provide that oversight because that licensing function falls to us. Also, as Director Psyche mentioned, so many of our providers are doing really excellent work. And we want to highlight that excellent work and make sure that we are working with the facilities that are struggling and bringing them up to that same level. Just to give you a sense of the numbers of setting types we have in the state, this chart shows you the numbers of facilities in each of our categories. As far as memory care, we don't have separate standalone memory care licensure. So you must be licensed as one of the underlying facility types, the nursing facility, assisted living, or residential care. And then you seek the endorsement on top of that underlying licensure. And so you'll see that in nursing, we have 11 nursing facilities that have that endorsement, 182 of the other category that have that endorsement. If you seek that endorsement, there's different requirements, a different set of rules. There is a higher Medicaid reimbursement rate, slightly more training directed at dementia care, and requires a locked facility, a diagnosis of dementia or Alzheimer's. Outdoor space that is secure, those types of things. What the literature tells us, though, is that it's likely that residents living in the other settings that aren't endorsed memory care, close up to probably 70%, suffer from some form of dementia or Alzheimer's in those non-endorsed settings. So even in our adult foster homes, that's what we probably estimate we would see if we had diagnoses for all of our consumers. So we have struggled. We struggled to use our full authority under current law, and that's some of the work that I've been doing since taking this position as the director. We do have a wide range of authority under current law, and so we have been using more of that in recent months with our providers to make sure that they can come back into compliance. We've also had challenges where the different parts of our organization within DHS, we're not communicating effectively, our licensing division not communicating as well as it could with our adult protective services workers or with the programmatic leadership. So we've made some changes there. Also, our staffing levels for the licensors have not kept pace with the growth of the long-term care industry. We also have data systems that are a challenge, and we've also recognized that we have those systems, but we also haven't been very good at setting the standards for data entry. So the things that we've done on this slide, we have reintegrated the licensing staff from the former Office of Licensing and Regulatory Oversight back into the program so that there's a clear line of sight for the program director in seeing how those functions are occurring. We're also issuing conditions on facilities much more quickly than we had before by collaborating to see what's happening in the abuse world, using that information when we have it within the agency, and then taking action. Before, that was taking a really long time, months and months sometimes, from when an incident occurred to when we took that formal licensing condition action. A condition is just a compliance tool that we can use to help the provider get back into substantial compliance. And it's things like asking the facility to seek an RN consultant to come in for a certain number of hours every week to work with the direct staff, seeking a management company to come in and work with the facility about overall operations, specific training requirements around the particular issue we've seen. If there was an issue with not self-reporting abuse, we would want the facility and their staff to do a training on how to self-report immediately when an issue arises. Other things like medication management. And then we can also restrict new admissions into the facility until the facility can get back into substantial compliance. So this is a tool we've been using a lot in recent months. We've done a lot of work in funding projects through our program and agency related to dementia care. And I'm not going to get into all the details here because I know our time is short, but I'd be happy to come talk with any of you about these specific projects and what we think they've done or can do moving forward for Oregonians. We've also done a number of things that have been collaborative with other organizations, stakeholders, partners, and trainings. And we've had some of our staff go present at national conferences around dementia and Alzheimer's. So I think we're continuously trying to define quality of care in long-term care. And this was an excerpt from a journal article, a professional journal that I found that talks about different domains that define quality of care in a long-term care setting. I think, you know, most obviously we fall into working on regulatory performance with the providers, but I also think we tangentially are involved or policies are made around some of those other components, and we really have to work with our provider partners to make sure that we're striking the right balance and that we have capacity to serve Oregonians. Just to demonstrate the action that we've taken in this new lens that we have at DHS, we have had to do a number of immediate suspensions in adult foster homes. And so you'll see the numbers from 2014, 2015, 2016. And those are due to extreme situations where there are safety concerns, immediate threats to health and welfare, where we have to shut the facility down immediately. And then the blue line represents conditions that we've done in facilities to really work with those foster homes to get them back into compliance. In the assisted living and residential care facility arena, which would include the biggest chunk of the memory care endorsed communities, you can see that there's been a pretty dramatic uptick in the use of conditions as a mechanism to gain compliance for those providers in the past year. And I think for purposes of this hearing, it's important to point out that memory care communities make up 34% of the total licensed facilities, but 55% of conditions issued between January 1st of this year and November 30th of this year. These are the things that we are setting out to do in the coming months and years. Implementation of a statewide abuse management system. We still don't have in place a system whereby I could log in and see what things are being screened in and screened out, what the status is of different abuse investigations, when I can expect them completed. And so we're pretty far down the path of getting this system implemented. We're doing a transfer system from Colorado so that statewide we have a handle and a cross program. It doesn't just impact aging and people with disabilities. It'll allow other programs to be able to see across what's happening in the abuse realm. And then rolling out Aspen, which is a database to our adult foster home licensors, because it's also very difficult from a leadership perspective for us to see what's going on in adult foster homes and their compliance without going and looking at files in local offices across the state. So we're kind of behind the times there, and we're moving towards using this system that's used in the other setting types. We have to continue to overhaul the way that we function as a state agency to better protect Oregon's long-term care consumers. We are faced with the challenge of more and more people to serve. We have an aging population, and we have budgetary and staffing constraints, as always. But we are committed to working with our provider partners and committed to ensuring that Oregonians live in safe environments with choice and independence and dignity at the forefront. Thank you.
So, Chair Kinnegar, I just want to add one thing. So You know, I think one of the things I was concerned about is I wanted to make sure that as you looked across the department, no matter what the safety issue is, we're dealing with different populations with some consistency. And so really what we do is twice a month we have a safety review team, which includes people involved in program areas across the department, our investigators, certifiers, you know, just a cross-section of people across the department. And we actually staff facilities we're concerned about. And so I don't want to get the idea that Ashley's making and her staff are making decisions in a vacuum, because I attend every one of those meetings, and in most cases directly and engage in the conversation of should we issue a condition or should we issue a suspension. And so I just wanted the committee to know that there's a level of consistency and oversight that we're trying to provide, because I think that's really important.
Representative Evans.
Two questions, and they can be for the future, but just for your... One is, all of this appears to be the regulatory side of the house. Where's the criminal aspect? I mean, at a point where abuse is clearly impacting the safety of somebody, I'd like to know more about, or I'd like to see on paper where the line is between corporate malfeasance and actually actionable criminal behavior that we can say this isn't going to happen anymore. The second thing, and this is something I wish I didn't have to say, but I think is true, is as we look into the next year with the current budget climate we have and the current incoming federal administration and some of the things that have been said about care, safety, yes, independence may be one of the things that becomes less and less a priority in terms of the funding models coming from D.C. So one of the questions I really would like to know is, should funding drop with these different programs, what is the internal prioritization process whereby we try to stretch as much as we can and at some point say we can't? And I think that those are adult conversations we're going to have going into a budget climate, and I'd like to know what the internal dynamics are.
Absolutely.
You'll answer another time, it sounds like. And okay. Did you have a question?
I can wait.
Okay. Representative Bueller.
Yeah, and you don't necessarily have to answer this question today, but I'd like to know about your internal process improvement methodology. You know, to speak to Representative Evans' point, you're not going to probably have more resources, yeah, either capital or people, so you have to innovate or use technology better. I'd like to hear about how you do that.
Okay. Yeah, we'd be happy to come back.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Well, then, since they're giving just statements of future things, you know, would love to know, you know, this delicate balance of safety choice and independence and the challenges that you guys have faced. You're implementing some changes. We didn't really see a whole lot about how do you measure success down the line, and as we move forward, how do we know are we succeeding or not? Just because we have more reports doesn't mean we're succeeding. So,
right, definitely.
But for another time.
Absolutely.
And I also will not ask you to respond necessarily, just so you know, because this will be a big topic in the session. So some of my questions had to do with, you know, there's been a big uptick in conditions, and it could be three different reasons. One is the population that's being served could be growing, as it is, over time. And so it could just be that there's way more numbers. So getting a percent might be helpful in there. Secondly, it could be that for whatever reason, there's been some change in something that actually has created more incidents. That may be. I think that's probably less likely, but that could be a possibility. But the third seems to be most likely is that you've tightened up your accountability, because it's almost doubled in a lot of different areas, that you're using tools that perhaps you previously didn't make as much use of, and the fact that you've got brought licensing back under you maybe gives you more of the ability to really drive some of that expectation of excellence. So don't need to answer it now, but those were some of the questions that came about. Sure. I do know in the question about finances and how do you get quality, there have been ideas on the table, and they were circulated with, you know, the task force that I was informally running that had to do with fees and fines, fees that go to support the program and the extent to which they do or don't cover your operations. Because this is, again, as we look ahead, especially in a very streamlined, you know, fiscally restrained environment, is the are the fees that are being paid for licensing fees covering the cost of operation? So again, don't feel like you need to answer there, but I'm curious about that. And then how do our fines work, and is that an opportunity where fines can provide an incentive to do the right thing? They can also be a source of funding to help incentivize good behavior. So those will be areas that I know that we'll be wanting to look at. Would love your perspective later. And so just know some of those are some of the issues on the table. So thank you so much.
You bet.
Thank you.
Okay, so now we've got Tracy Morgan and Linda Kirschbaum from the Purple Ribbon Commission. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Stark, and Vice Chair Peluso, members of the committee, thank you so much for this opportunity to be here today and present on the Purple Ribbon Commission. My name is Tracy Morgan. I'm the Executive Director for the Alzheimer's Association Oregon Chapter and the Co-Chair for the Purple Ribbon Commission. To set the stage for our presentation on the work of the Purple Ribbon Commission, I want to start with some quotes that led our conversations and our Purple Ribbon Commission event that we held. These quotes come from individuals who are caregivers, have dementia themselves, or Alzheimer's. The first one was a wife and caregiver to her husband who has younger onset Alzheimer's, a retired attorney who had a traumatic brain injury resulting in permanent memory deficit, a retired neurologist from OHSU who has two copies of the APOE4 gene, which ultimately led to Alzheimer's, a caregiver for his mother, and an advocate for seniors. These quotes are a sample of the powerful priorities that were placed in front of the commissioners and helped shape the work of this commission. I am determined to get rid of this disease. I don't want it to affect my son. It took me quite a long time to adjust to this reality. Throughout this period of what I call transition, I found a sense of balance in my life that didn't exist previously. We need information, a roadmap, and someone to navigate this journey with us. We are all terrified of what we will become. We have to support families. It is our duty as a society. I believe it is important to keep in mind that Alzheimer's is more than a disease about memory loss. Alzheimer's disease is a fatal disease. It is the sixth leading cause of death. Nearly one in every three seniors dies with Alzheimer's or dementia. Today, an estimated 62,000 Oregonians aged 65 and older are living with Alzheimer's. This number is projected to significantly grow. By 2025, we expect this number will be 84,000 Oregonians, a 35% increase in less than 10 years. There are currently over 178,000 family members providing care and support for people with Alzheimer's in Oregon. With an ever-increasing number affected, lack of treatments, and enormous costs, Alzheimer's disease is a threat unlike any other. To achieve meaningful progress against Alzheimer's disease, it will take all of us and must be considered as a public health crisis. For 34 years, the Alzheimer's Association Oregon Chapter has provided education and support for people diagnosed, their families, and caregivers. With five offices across the state, the Oregon Chapter serves all 36 counties with resources, programs, and services. Additionally, we have hundreds of colleagues joining us in 81 chapters across the country. In response to the concerns about the quality of care in memory care communities raised over the last year and the desire to create a gold standard, the Alzheimer's Association and the Oregon Healthcare Association joined together to convene the Purple Ribbon Commission. Our goal was to bring together an independent entity of commissioners comprised of aging and dementia experts in Oregon that could continue to inform this discussion. In addition to memory care, which represents only about 10% of the people affected by this disease, we wanted to look across all care settings, including and not forgetting the majority of people who stay in their home. In late November, the Purple Ribbon Commission convened for a two-day event to step back and apply a broader, objective lens to Alzheimer's disease and other dementias in Oregon. The Commission's task was to develop a set of policy and practice recommendations to advance quality dementia care services and supports. The 14 members of the Commission included subject matter experts like nationally recognized dementia researcher Dr. Jeff Kay from OHSU, Alzheimer's and aging experts, Dr. Karen Brown Wilson of the Jesse F. Richardson Foundation, Fred Steele, long-term care ombudsman, care providers like geriatric nurse practitioner Liz Van Walsham of Elder Health and Living, and Dr. Merle Hernandez, CEO of Concepts and Community Living. You should all have a two-page document that you have in front of you listing all of our commissioners and their affiliations. In order to inform the Commission's policy and practice recommendations, commissioners first convened during a day-long symposium to review and evaluate information presented by national and state Alzheimer's and dementia experts, family caregivers, individuals living with Alzheimer's and dementia, state regulators, and dementia service providers. Using this additional information and their own expert opinions and experiences, commissioners were convened to further discuss and review presented innovative and evidence-based practices for advancing quality dementia care in Oregon. The overall agenda was formulated by identifying timely and topical issues around dementia care in Oregon and the national level. We sought out experts in key areas to present to this commission. In order to drive a clear, proactive, and results-oriented agenda, the key areas were narrowed to the following: family and consumer supports and programs, quality metrics and information to measure success, acuity-based staffing models and workforce development, caregiver training and competencies. With that, I will wrap up as my colleague Linda will share more information about the process and outcomes of the Purple Ribbon Commission. Again, thank you for this opportunity to be here.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Peluso, and Vice Chair Stark. For the record, my name is Linda Kirschbaum. I'm the Senior Vice President for Quality and Services for the Oregon Healthcare Association, a professional nonprofit trade association representing the full spectrum of long-term care support and services, both in the not-for-profit and for-profit sector. Our mission is to improve the lives of seniors and people with disabilities by educating and advocating for quality care. We've been in existence for six decades, and our members employ tens of thousands of persons serving tens of thousands of Oregonians. We are truly honored to be co-conveners with our partner, and we have a long legacy of working together with the Alzheimer's Association. And to work with such an esteemed group of dementia care subject matter experts and professionals. Again, we thank you for your interest and the opportunity to brief you on the important work of the Commission. I must say, professionally and personally, I have been involved in long-term and dementia care for over 30 years. I've experienced the joys, and I've also experienced the agony of the disease from a multitude of perspectives. First, as a daughter, my father had frontal lobe dementia, and he passed away 19 years ago at the age of 73. Second, as a granddaughter, my paternal grandmother lived in the nursing home that I was the administrator for 4 years until she passed away at the age of 92. And thirdly, I'm a niece, very large family, so multiple aunties and uncles who have had and who have Alzheimer's. I am very interested in the research and the cure, but in the meantime, my uncle actually lives here in Salem in a very excellent memory care community. In my current role, I'm an educator, an advocate, and a quality improvement specialist. So we typically look at things through the lens of if there's a problem or an area for improvement, then what are the typical process steps to go through to look at a situation, evaluate it, and then come up with solutions. The commissioners support and hold great hope, again, for a cure, but in the meantime, there is work to be done and supports to be provided to those who live with the disease themselves and for those who are caring for them. So our process for the commission, as Tracy said, was to convene a one-day symposium at OHSU. To set the stage, we engaged in a deliberate and thoughtful and quality improvement principled process to really evaluate what information was out there around our four key topic areas. We also believe that the work of the commission and the recommendations put forth align with current work that is being done in quality initiatives around dementia care. So, for example, STATO, the state plan for Alzheimer's disease in Oregon, Oregon Care Partners, which is a training program that was funded by the legislature 3 years ago, and the Oregon Partnership for Dementia Care, which is another work group looking to advance understanding and information about this disease. We hope to create a strong and responsive and well-laid path forward to enhancing quality dementia care in Oregon and informing thoughtful, well-reasoned, balanced public policy. In order to inform the Commission's policy and practice recommendations, again, we convened for the day-long session at OHSU to hear from the national experts on aging, dementia, et cetera. Presentations included, as Tracy mentioned, a panel of family caregivers as well as those affected by the disease themselves. Needless to say, their comments were powerful. And those stories and insights were beyond compelling and completely affirmed why we had put the Purple Ribbon Commission together. Additionally, we heard from national aging experts, Karen Brown Wilson, Tipa Snow, who is a dementia education expert, and what the Oregon Care Partners has based a lot of their family and paid caregiver training curriculum on. It is very powerful. The national and state dementia briefings, we had two panels that addressed both of those areas. And presentations ranged from looking at evidence-informed models of care and training, models that have been adopted by the Alzheimer's Association nationally for dementia training curriculum that we would like to use, family supports, education support groups, life enrichment for those affected themselves, programs such as Music Now, Memories in the Making, which are music therapy types of programs, art therapy programs. There's actually these programs are being used in public-private partnerships. The Oregon Symphony is involved. It's pretty powerful and pretty amazing work that's being done. And all of our colleagues should be very proud. We addressed quality metric research, recommendations, and the absolute need for data to help inform where improvements are needed and how success is being measured. How do we measure success? What are those holistic quality indicators to do that? We took a look at our historical background. Oregon has such a rich and strong tradition, over 30 years of long-term care, person-centered care, and was one of the first states in the country to really develop and strong regulatory standards for those endorsed dementia care units. We looked at a variety of evidence-informed training from the boots on the ground, if you will. So we had our final presentation from a variety of provider types, everything from adult daycare programs to the music, the art programs, as well as the licensed facility settings. The key messages there were training is foundational to quality care. You can throw someone into a room with a video player and videos that are 10 years old, and you could check off the box and say they're trained, but it will not produce good outcomes for residents and families. So we looked at those folks who had been using evidence-based programs such as the CARES online training through the Alzheimer's Association and the Tipa Snow positive approaches are just two examples. These also help in reducing staff turnover. When staff are well trained, they're well engaged, they create those connections with the families, with the caregivers, and you have stronger relations there and better outcomes. So we offered Q&A for all of the commissioners with all of the panels as well as the invited guests on the first day. We then set out on our workday session. We took all of the information gained to come up with a set of recommendations, which
I am getting to. You do have a copy of what we consider our first draft. It's still in the works, but we're nearly complete with the general broad recommendations, and calling those the gold standard that can help us inform reliable, accountable, and strategic public policy to support persons and those families. So our four areas, as Tracy said, family and consumer supports. Our broad statement is we support programs that will enable those affected by dementia and their loved ones to receive the best information and resources regarding the disease. Again, that message was clear from the folks that spoke. We didn't know where to go. You know, when you're faced, you don't think your situation, if somebody's diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's, that is not something that's generally crossing your mind and where to turn. The quality metrics and ways to track and measure success, we believe there are limited indicators to illustrate a holistic representation of quality dementia care. Data and quality metrics demonstrate success in dementia care, and quality care is driven through key indicators. So we hope to create a set of quality indicators that will have key metrics as well as incentives and disincentives. The data that is proposed, yes, there's been an increase in the number of conditions, and that is absolutely appropriate use. The department has a large toolbox with lots of tools in it to address those types of situation. I do want to say on the flip side, as I'm always the optimist, that represents 6% of the providers, of the licensed providers. So we still have 94% that are out there in compliance and doing a good job. But truly, without a full set of metrics, not just the compliance, we don't have a clear picture. Are residents and families satisfied? What's the staff retention level? So those are some of the things that we are recommending. Acuity-based staffing models and workforce development. We recognize there are workforce challenges in dementia care. The need is great, and we encourage participation and want to incentivize participation for qualified Oregonians to work in this sector. Caregiver training and competencies. We know having adequate numbers of dementia-capable and competently trained staff is critical to providing high-quality care. So we were asked on our next steps and timelines. So we anticipate having a full report by early January that we will be happy to share. And it is our intent to draft proposed legislation for the coming session that will include and hopefully support some or many of these suggestions. We know that we can't do all of it. We know that there are budgetary restrictions and challenges ahead of us, but if we want to really support high quality and advanced quality dementia care in our state, we need to start there. We will convene additional work in 2017, and a goal is that the Purple Ribbon Commission become like a clearinghouse or a center for excellence for dementia care in Oregon. Again, we thank you for the opportunity, and if you have questions, we would gladly take them.
Thank you. Any questions? So I had the honor of coming to the first day. I think it was actually late October, not late November, because it was before the election. Representative McEwen couldn't come as a result of that, but I learned a lot from it and happened to know the woman who had the husband with the early onset. So I ran into her, didn't realize she was a part of that process, but really appreciate the work that you're doing and look forward to your recommendations in January and look forward to working on that legislation. Great. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Okay, and we asked Fred Steele to come. You're actually a part of this work group. You can speak as a member of the Purple Ribbon Commission, but we also thought it'd be important to have you as the ombudsman for long-term care to just speak with that hat as well. Nothing specific, but you just heard two presentations, and you know we've been looking at this area. So whatever you would like to add.
Yeah, and I appreciate it. So Fred Steele, I'm the state long-term care ombudsman and director of the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman on behalf of our office, and even more so our 180 volunteers. For those of you that, and I would imagine many of you are familiar with our program, and we work through volunteers. That's the foundation. We currently have approximately 180 volunteers around Oregon that are weekly, some of them daily, visiting care facilities, visiting residents, getting to know them, and advocating for them to ensure their rights, their dignity, and their independence in facilities. So given the time, and I don't want to be the one at the bottom of the agenda keeping you from your party.
You are.
Yes, I know. I'm going to try to provide a brief snapshot.
Yes.
And some numbers you've probably heard before. But in the context of what we heard from our partners, our stakeholders with Purple Ribbon Commission, Department of Human Services, there are 510 residential care and assisted living facilities in Oregon. When I started 14 months ago, I was told the number was 486. The facilities are growing. They're growing rapidly. They're expanding. In your own communities, you're probably seeing them go up, building, and they're building them fast. There's approximately 135 or 138, I believe, nursing facilities around the state. There's over 1,500 adult foster homes and adult foster care facilities and homes around the state. So in those different settings, 44,000 Oregonians living in long-term care, receiving assistance with activities of daily living. Our office, and again, I'll try to be brief with the snapshot, and it is just a snapshot, but our top five complaints that our office has dealt with since January: 264 cases of discharge and eviction, 210 cases addressing concerns around medication administration, and these are complaints. They're not all founded, but it is the easy number that we track in our office. 168 issues with proper care planning, 161 with food quality and choice, sometimes dietary, health-related. These are issues that our volunteers are dealing with, and we only have approximately 180 volunteers for those number of facilities, so it is very much just a snapshot. Point in mentioning these numbers more than anything. There's some excellent facilities out there. Linda gave you a percentage of 94% and 6%, and those were based on conditions. There's still other facilities where there's a need for improvement, and we would all acknowledge that. That's why we have a Purple Ribbon Commission. That's why the legislature is involved. Created its task force to get involved and look at these issues. Very much appreciate that. So, given these snapshots, all I have to say or request is that on behalf of those 44,000 Oregonians living in long-term care, mm-hmm. depending on a structure and a system to provide high-quality care, high quality of life, I appreciate any involvement, and again, with all our partners, our stakeholders, and any legislative interest, if it's appropriate going forward. So thank you.
Thank you so much. Any questions?
Just a comment. Be careful what you ask for. Legislative interest.
Sure.
Yep. Thank you so much. Okay. We're getting down to the end here. Clyde, I was going to have you report, but I think I'm not going to do that because I want us to be able to catch the end. But we will look forward before the start of the session to get a highlight from you of what are the new investments that might be in the governor's budget, what are the cuts to the human services in the governor's budget, what are some of the things that you would hoped would be there. That was what I wanted, was kind of a high level. I know seniors, given that we're just talking about seniors, we had closed the Gatekeepers program last time around. I know a lot of people wanted to bring that back. OPI has gone through a very dramatic cut. There are a number of other areas that seniors have not fared well in this particular budget, and I think we're going to be looking at what we can do to restore and even move ahead in some of that. If we can find some more revenue. So to stay tuned, I'd say. The other things that we have on here, member bill preview. I wanted to give people an opportunity if they want to say anything. Nope, great. We'll be hearing from you later. It's got the evil eye going. And work session introduction of committee legislative concepts. We don't have any. There are a lot of individual bills that are going to be coming our way, so we're not going to be twiddling our thumbs in the beginning of the session. I know people intend to drop some bills early, so we will have things to work on. There's there's always a big debate about whether there should be committee bills or people should have their names put on them. Sometimes there's a reason to have it committee bills, but I am perfectly happy to have people put their names on them as well for transparency. So in that vein, we don't have any committee bills. We may in the future leave that option open. And if so, I'll probably explain why I think it should be a committee bill and not a personal bill. But we don't have that work to do. So with that, I'm going to close the informational hearing and close the House Committee on Human Services and Housing for the day. Thank you. House Committee on Human Services and Housing for the day. Thank you.